to Exile on Bad Street, episode 31. I'm your host, Chris Zellner, and I have a great show lined up for you today, folks, because I have a guy on here with me today that the 16-year-old version of me would be just going nuts talking to this guy right now because he was such a fan of his, and even that's like 21 years ago, and I'm trying not to make you feel old, but that was one of my most favorite runs and one of my most favorite territories, Memphis, USWA, and I am joined by the legendary manager of champions, Germantown, Tennessee's finest, Scott Bowden. Scott, how you doing, brother?
Man, I'm just reveling in that introduction. That may be the best introduction I've ever had in my entire life.
Yeah, I remember that I was getting Memphis at the time. My brother had one of those big salad dishes, and he got America One, and Memphis was airing on there. And I hadn't seen Memphis on a regular basis for about a year or so. So he starts taping this for me, that and ECW and Smoky Mountain, and they had this wrestling block. But I start seeing Memphis, and I see you, you're managing Tommy Rich and Doug Gilbert, and feuding with PG-13, and it's like, oh my God, this is Memphis the way I remember it. And it was just a great era, and I tell you, that was just the last great run of Memphis, and that's something that we'll talk about when we do another show, because I definitely want to do two shows, one on your career as a performer and one as your time as a fan of the promotion. And, you know, if you green your blog, Kentucky Fried Wrestling, you know, you go back a long way. You have a great memory of stuff in Memphis. And when would you say that you were, like, you first became, like, the super fan that you were?
The summer of 77, the first series of matches between Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee, they were just absolutely insane. You know, it seemed to get crazier each and every week. You know, Memphis running every week at the Mid-South Coliseum, you know, you had the TV show, but then the shows themselves at the Coliseum had to be very episodic and had to kind of have a cliffhanger and a hook to bring you not back 2 weeks later, not back 3 weeks later, but the very next week in the same building. And they sure did that. And they were able to do that with the exact same match, which I think is remarkable. I mean, I think they headlined maybe eight weeks in a row. And started out, I think the first show drew about 5,700, and then as the stakes got higher, so did the crowds.
Yeah, you look at the shows. You're starting basically on July the 4th. Actually, is the first big match. But it's cool to mention though. Before this, is like 2 weeks before, Jerry Lawler had a series of matches with Dusty Rhodes that people don't know about. June 12th and 19th.
Right.
You know, think about that. Right. In 77. And that's some stuff that's like, you know, we've seen the Last Battle of Atlanta come out, you know, yesterday as we record this on WWE Network. Lawler and Dusty in 1977. That's some Holy Grail type shit right there, folks. Believe me.
Man, I'm telling you. That series of matches popped into my head. There are a number of them that I haven't, because that was right before I became a fan. And quickly thereafter, I was a huge fan of the wrestling magazines. But we can get to that too.
Oh yeah,
but
we'll get to that.
I think those Dusty matches, I think they drew less than 7,000 fans. You know, and then as soon as they started turning up the heat on Lawler and Dundee, you know, it quickly escalated to, I think, 8,000 fans and 9,000, and then the head shaving matches, both I think with Dundee's head getting shaved and his wife. Bev getting her head shaved. I think both those drew over 10,000. They didn't quite sell out, but they came close.
Yeah, and you look at the stips. The first match, Lawler had to pin Dundee twice in 15 minutes. Both put $2,000 on the line. Dundee won. Then you come back the next week, steel cage match. Lawler had to pin Dundee twice in 15 minutes. Dundee was putting up now $4,000 against Jerry Lawler's car. All right, they get a week off because they. Lawler's working Orndorff and Dundee's working Plowboy Frazier. They come back.
Okay.
The 25th, Dundee beats Lawler, Carr versus title to win the Southern Heavyweight title. August 1st, Lawler beats Dundee in a rematch to win the title, and a title versus Carr match. Then August 8th, what was that?
And that's the Cadillac is back up for grabs there, right?
Yes, the Cadillac. That's right. Then you have a dart match, basically, because Lawler works Orndorff, then works Dundee in a dart, well, not a dart match, but a lights out match or whatever you want to call it, as Dundee beat Lawler. Then that was 11,000 people in that show. Then you had the 15th of August, where Lawler beats Dundee in another hair versus car match, where Lawler's manager, Mickey Poole's hair, is on the line. And then you go to the 22nd, where Dundee beats Lawler in the hair versus hair match to win the Southern title, where Mickey Poole lost his hair. Then you go to the 29th, it's Texas Death, Southern title, in a hair versus car match, where Lawler wins. Then you go to September the 5th, hair versus hair. Lawler beats Dundee, so Dundee gets his head shaved in front of 10,000 fans. Then the September 13th show, Lawler beats Dundee, no DQ, hair versus hair by countout, where Dundee's wife Beverly got her head shaved. And then Lawler just retires right after that match.
Well, and then you can tell, too, Jerry Jarrett timed it perfectly because the hair versus hair match with Lawler drew over 10,000 people. And then the next week when they came back with Bev, they drew less than 9,000. So, yeah, so he absolutely timed it perfectly. And at that point, you know, I think the fans were at that point were begging, they were dying to cheer for Lawler, you know, because he was so over and so funny with his promos. You know, that chemistry that he had with Lance Russell was remarkable. You know, Lance Russell, probably one of the greatest straight men in the history of wrestling and maybe in entertainment, and just the perfect foil for Lawler's insults.
Yeah, and the retirement, that was because he wanted to start the music career, right?
Come on now.
That was the excuse, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. Gee, are you kidding me? That's funny. Yeah, that's what he, you know, he, at that point, you know, God, Lawler was just so ahead of his time. You know, everybody points to Japan as being the influence for a lot of the stuff that WWF did in the 80s. But, you know, Lawler was, you know, had all, you know, four or five different t-shirts, not only for sale at the wrestling matches, but in Lansky's, which mainly sold men's suits, but they also sold Jerry Lawler t-shirts. And I had a bright red one with a yellow picture of Jerry Lawler's mug on it. Most of my friends did too. You know, we would make little cardboard cutouts of his crown shaped goatee, and we would, you know, glue it to our chins and strut around and try to cut promos and all that stuff. So yeah, I think at that point in 77, you know, the fans were just dying to cheer him. And so Jarrett, I think, realized that he, you know, needed to kind of pull him out of the spotlight for a little bit and then bring him back as a babyface. But I think they brought him back a little sooner than they had anticipated because they knew the crowds would dip, but I don't think they realized how much.
Funny how that works out, didn't it? Because that happens again later on in time.
Yeah.
But it was a smart move, though, because it was perfect timing for the next guy that's coming in. As Handsome Jimmy Valiant shows up in Memphis the week later, wins the vacant Southern Heavyweight title. And folks, if you've never seen Jimmy Valiant in Memphis, if you've just seen him as Boogie Woogie Man Jimmy Valiant for Crockett Promotions, you're doing yourself a disservice. Because Handsome Jimbo from Memphis was just tremendous. What did you think of Valiant in the late 70s in Memphis?
I think his Memphis stuff, I think he was probably one of the best promo guys of all time. And fans actually took him seriously. I mean, he had some tremendous brawls with Lawler. I mean, just out and out bloody. You know, he could do the comedy and he did the pop culture references. But, you know, he cuts a great promo and it kind of sets up the deal where he busts the Coke bottle over Lawler's head when he's working with Harley Race. He does this great promo. I guess Lawler had thrown fire at him. And burned, you know, temporarily blinded him. And he's got this great promo, and he ends it, and he goes, King, you're dead, and drops the microphone. And he's like, get the camera off me. This ain't no freak show. he seemed just like a guy who was just on the edge and desperate and would do just about anything to end Jerry Lawler's career. So, yeah, I mean, his stuff, I mean, I liked his stuff later on. Valiant, I think, always got a free pass from the fans in Memphis, because they loved his interviews, and even though his matches typically, especially when he got into like 83, 84, the matches weren't very good. But the fans just, he was super over in Memphis.
Yeah, and he's one of those guys where he got himself over so big that he could always come back, and he could, like you said, kind of coast because he was who he was. And, his feud with Lawler, it spanned years and years and years, and they were either, face each other or team up with each other, which that's the story of all of Lawler's rivals, basically. But,
what's interesting to me, too, about that, and I know we're kind of jumping ahead years a little bit, like in 78, when Valiant was, he was getting super over as a babyface and doing all these great interviews talking about, how Burt Reynolds and Sally Field had just dropped him off at the Channel 5 studio, and Burt had slipped something in his Coca-Cola. he fired up and all this kind of stuff. And Lance Russell trying to keep a straight face during it all. That same day that his music video aired for Son of a Gypsy, that's the same show where they turned him heel.
Yes.
And I can't help but think there was actually, and Valiant, maybe the lines were blurred a little bit with what was real and what was a work. But Valiant kind of goes, I sense this jealousy from you, King. I sense this jealousy from you, because he didn't want to, Lawler didn't want to cut him in on the main event. the timing of it just tells me that maybe Lawler didn't like it too much that Valiant was getting over like that.
And you know what? That's kind of a running deal as well with Lawler over in years later, where other guys had claimed that as well. So, you definitely could be right there. Valiant was becoming a big deal. And just in the law, him and Lawler, they're feuding against each other. You're looking at 10,000 fans, almost 9,000 fans. They did screw up one thing bad. They did a match on January 23rd, 78. Where they had a hair versus hair match, and it went to a no contest, and neither got shaved. And the fans rioted and caused over $2,000 in damage in the Minsoft Coliseum.
Yep. They never came back with the hair versus hair stipulations between those two. Now, and this is talk about Holy Grail. This is one thing that I would love to see again, and one thing that I vividly remember. I don't know if it was around this time when they were having these great matches in January and February, and I guess they were teasing the hair versus hair. But Lawler had won the belt from Valiant, won the Southern title, and Valiant was so irate he didn't even want to wait till next Monday night. He wanted to have a match on television to get a shot at the belt. And Lawler said, "Okay, I'll give you the belt, but you got to put your hair at stake." And so Lawler comes out there and, has like one of his artist drawings where he shows like before and after of Valiant with his hair and without. And they have this great kind of bloody brawl, and Joe LaDuke involved, and he comes out and bear hugs Lawler till he's unconscious and the referee's knocked out, and Lawler just collapses and Valiant pins him. And it was just great television. I would love to see that angle again.
Yeah, and Joe LaDuke's a guy we'll talk about in a few minutes. He would become an impact player. But real quick, to get off of Lawler and Valiant real quick, in the tag team side of things, there was a tag team that was starting to dominate in this time period, Phil Hickerson and Dennis Condrey. And Jim Cornette has gone on record many times as saying that he thought that Hickerson and Condrey may have been the best tag team he ever saw. What are your memories of the Hickerson-Condrey tag team?
I remember they had some great bouts with Lawler and Dundee, and just I was young then and I was a fan, so obviously I hated them. But it was almost like without going back and looking at some of their stuff and really studying what they did, I just remember them being involved in great matches and great angles. And then to go back years later as a fan and try to find some of their stuff. which is there's actually not a lot of it out there. I found a match from Jonesboro, Arkansas, that it's Hickerson and Condry. It's Lawler. God, I can't even think of who Lawler's partner is now. But yeah, they were magic. They really were. And Jerry Jarrett says the same thing. Probably one of the most talented teams he ever had working for him.
Yeah, it's a shame that more of their stuff isn't available, because again, you just could see Phil Hickerson. What a tremendous performer that guy was. You know.
Well, you know, years later, he kind of got his due. You know, and when he came back in the '80s and he did that King of Jackson stuff and turned babyface with Lawler and cut all those great promos. I mean, you know, they had that program with the Freebirds, and they were, you know, that was in I guess that was in '85, right?
Summer '85, yep.
Yeah, and they were drawing between 7,000 and 10,000 people there for that series. So you know, Phil was super over.
Yeah, and for a guy who basically for the first 4 years of the '80s was sitting in Jackson, Tennessee, you know, not right. performing.
Yeah. Yeah, came back and just like he had never left, and you know, then obviously the business had greatly changed, and he didn't have the physique, but it's, you know, it's funny, you know, he beat Scott Steiner several times and Terry Taylor, and they when they put the international title on him, probably, you know, the unlikeliest of pushes, but they brought in all these, you know, they brought in Harley Race did a job for him, suddenly Phil Hickerson is a main event player. Yeah. And again, that's one of those things that at that time it could probably only happen in a place like Memphis.
Oh, and that's why Memphis is its own world in wrestling. I love it to death. And another reason for stuff like that is you look at some of these cards in March 78, you see a name on here, Darth Vader. And Jerry Lawler, one thing you can always say about Lawler is he was always, you know, booking pop culture type gimmicks, whether monster gimmicks or, you know, gimmicks related to movies or whatever. But Darth Vader in 1978, that's a pretty cool deal. What'd you think of like when Lawler would have these Dr. Franks and Darth Vaders and characters like that as part of the show? Do you think that it hurt the product and made it look more cartoonish, or what'd you think?
You know, personally, I loved it because, you know, as a kid who was into everything pop culture, you know, almost every character that they brought in during that time period. You know, we even had I found one lineup somewhere. I wrote a column about this called "The Ghost of Memphis Wrestling Past," and it has you know, all these different gimmicks. And I think I looked at a card and had listed on there as appearing the Kisser, which was Wayne Ferris dressed as Gene Simmons, the Kojak, and I don't know. Yeah, you know, just a white bald dude, and Lord Darth Vader, all on the same bill, and maybe even a Riddler. Lawler's love of comics and pop culture definitely made its way into the cards, and that was all Lawler stuff. That certainly wasn't Jerry Jarrett's idea of booking. But in a way though, I don't think it hurt the, in a weird way, it's that sort of stuff worked in Memphis, you know, and it's hard to explain because Memphis really, they love variety, I think is what, you know, and that's why when Lawler started getting influence and he would do the booking and it would be 6 months of, you know, insane gimmicks, all kinds of gimmick matches and wild brawls and all the emphasis on titles would go out the window. And then when Jerry Jarrett took it over, it was like a little bit more grounded and a little bit more emphasis on wrestling. And he would fire a lot of the gimmick guys. And usually that's when Lawler would Lawler would come out there and do those promos about like, I'm looking in the wrestling magazines and I'm not rated in the top 10. And I'm going to rectify that situation and start knocking off those guys to get a shot at the world title. And when Memphis did that kind of stuff, when they had that serious approach, that's when I really loved it, because as a fan growing up in a city that didn't have a pro sports team, I ate that stuff up. You know, I think we all got behind Lawler as, you know, especially, you know, he was a skinny kid who grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, went to Treadwell High School and became the Southern Heavyweight Wrestling Champion. So that was like our role model.
And that's a great point. You know, that
yeah.
I mean, yeah, you're exactly right. Memphis had no pro sports teams, and you got a deal here where you have something going on every Monday night, sometimes Tuesday, sometimes Sunday, in your town, and it's like the pro sports event. You know, that's a great point.
Well, there was a great line in the commercial appeal newspaper by the sports columnist, and he said that if a pro sports team is ever going to succeed in Memphis, they're going to have wrestling matches at halftime.
yeah. And I remember, when the USFL came in, the Memphis Showboats, that Pepper Rogers, the head coach, you know, formed a relationship with Jerry Lawler. You know, they he would go on the Jerry Lawler show.
Yeah. Oh yeah, all the time. Yeah, I don't think Lex Luger ever made an appearance because Larry Fole was playing for the Showboats then, and supposedly he was like one of the few guys on the team who never watched wrestling, never watched the Channel 5 show.
Gee, yes, I could see that for old Lex. Now,
I'm looking at the cover of City of Memphis magazine from November of '76, and on the cover is this great, which is another story. This great shot of Lawler wearing the NWA World Title belt that Lawler was having a match with Terry Funk in '76, and Memphis magazine was there writing a story. And they had an area set up to take some photos before and after his match. And they did a deal where I guess the match ended in controversy. Lawler pinned Funk, but Funk had his foot on the ropes. But Lawler went to the dressing room with the belt anyway. And before Terry could get back, he put the belt on and told the photographer, hurry up, take my picture.
And they showed on television. I've seen the promo where they showed on television.
I posted that promo online.
There you go.
I got that footage, and then it wound up on the cover of the magazine.
Amazing.
Headline says, "What does this man have that Larry Zonka didn't have?" I guess Larry Zonka had played for the World Football League Memphis Southmen, and they, you know, and it was a failed franchise. It says, "Answer: a packed house."
Yeah, that was the big deal that Larry Zonka, Paul Warfield, and Jim Kick all left the Miami Dolphins. You know, this is the year after they won their second Super Bowl and signed with the Memphis Southmen of the WFL. Oh, that's a great line. Wow.
Now, have you seen that? Have you ever seen that cover?
I think I've seen it.
Okay, all right.
I've seen that picture, definitely, on a promo, and I think I've seen the picture, like, online. So I'm pretty sure that's probably where I've seen it.
Yeah, it's pretty funny stuff. And I think that's one of the things too. I think word got around about that. I don't think Harley Race is too thrilled with Lawler.
Lawler wasn't challenging for an NWA title much too long after that for a while. That's for sure. Now, Joe LeDuc, we mentioned him in '78. That's when Joe LeDuc becomes a pretty big deal in Memphis, and everybody knows the promo where he takes the blood oath and all that stuff. And Joe LeDuc. You talk about Jimmy Valiant bringing a type of reality to promos. Joe LeDuc could take that to the next level. I mean, you actually believe this dude right here was crazy. And the spot where he threw Lawler off from the ring and hit that table, I mean, Jesus Christ. Joe LeDuc, I mean, he was a scary individual as a child, I'm sure, wasn't he?
Oh, man, yeah, just totally freaked me out. I mean, I thought he was probably the toughest guy on the planet. It's a perfect example too of, you know, we talk about, you know, Lawler and Dundee and Valiant and LeDuc, and then you had Sonny King there also. You know, all these guys, you know, all different shapes and sizes, all different looks, you know, no two guys looked exactly alike, you know, who were headlining. Just an incredible cast of characters, and you know, the whole lumberjack gimmick, and the test of strength where he was like, you know, he'd stop a bus with his legs and you know, and have eight men on each side trying to rip apart his bear hug and all this kind of stuff. And just, you know, and then it kind of capped off with that blood oath that he took where he cut his arm on live TV, which Jerry Jarrett and Lance Russell did not know about ahead of time.
Oh, that's nice.
I mean, Jerry Jarrett was like freaking out. He thought he was going to get thrown off the station.
Oh man, I can only imagine what how that went over with the station management seeing that on there.
Holy cow! Just absolutely insane. And Jerry after he calmed down, he asked Jerry, "Joe, oh, why did you do that?" He goes, "I don't know. I just got carried away." You know, he just got, you know, he was living that gimmick so hard. And I could see it. Lawler had some kind of brawl. Lawler had gotten the best of him earlier that day in the show. And so then he comes, you know, he goes to get his axe, but sometimes he carried to the ring. And he just, unbelievable that he just off the cuff just did that. And I asked Dave Brown what his memories of Joe LeDuc was. And he said, to be honest, because he was probably one of the nicest guys I've ever met in the profession. And for years after that, I always got a Christmas card from Joe LeDuc.
Amazing. Yeah, and look, I've heard those stories about LeDuc over the years too. One of the most soft-spoken men outside the ring, but buddy, when he was a heel, and he could tear it up, you know, with the best.
Oh, dude, absolutely one of the best big men. And man, and he would throw drop kicks. You know, at least during that run in 77, 78. He's tremendous, and a tremendous bump taker. He would sell Lawler's offense just unbelievably well, which, you know, that's a whole nother subject. You know, selling's kind of a lost art nowadays.
Oh yeah, a lot of ways, definitely. And he had Jean-Louis there with him as well.
Yeah.
They were a tag team. Sonny King was aligned with them, like you said. And that actually forced Lawler to, you know, work together with Bill Dundee and Jimmy Valiant. And they had some six-man matches, and Lawler and Dundee would team up, and Dundee and Valiant would team up. And that was like a real big triple threat of babyfaces at this time period in Memphis.
Yeah, and I think that's when they did the first ever hospital elimination match in Memphis.
Yep.
Which was essentially a first blood match.
Yeah.
And according to Jim Cornette, Nick Gulas invented that first in Nashville. But I just love that name, Hospital Elimination Match. And it was so unusual. You know, Memphis had this, obviously they filmed at WMC Studios, which is another great aspect that made Memphis unique. I don't know too many wrestling territories where the wrestling matches were the lead story on the number one sports broadcast in the Mid-South. You know, Jack Eaton, who was the announcer, he would lead with what took place that night in wrestling, and on Tuesday afternoons he would show highlights from the main event. And anyway, so they were doing this hospital elimination match, and they actually had Jack Eaton, the lead broadcaster in the city, sit down with Lawler and explain the rules for a hospital elimination match.
Amazing, and yet, and that's the relationship with the station, because Dave, of course, was the weatherman, you know.
Yeah,
and it was just. They were meant for each other in a lot of ways. And Jack Eaton, he did some work on the wrestling show too. He would fill in at times.
He did. Yeah, he loved it. He was always kind of tongue in cheek. It was always kind of like Jerry Calhoun rendered senseless by an errant blow to the head, suddenly recovers and counts three, and the good old king wins again.
Yeah.
And sometimes when he was calling things, you know, like there was I put a clip of the Lawler Bakulagil match from 79, world title versus world title. And Bakulagil lifts him up and he goes, and Bakulagil there lifts him up in a Dave, what is that there? and Dave goes, atomic drop. Oh, an atomic drop, eh?
Oh yeah, I tell you, it's funny when you see like the real news people like trying to get involved in the wrestling. It's something else.
Yeah.
Now Lawler and LeDuc, God, you look at the results and they're just going nonstop throughout 78. You know, their main event almost every Mid-South Coliseum card in some form or fashion. And what is the name here that before I get to this big show in August was a. Lute Des starts showing up at Memphis. How odd was that to see, you know, the great Lute Des mixing it up in Memphis?
Legit wrestlers. I mean, gimmick wrestlers were over big time, but Memphis also really appreciated legit wrestlers. And so, and the way that, you know, and as a kid, not really knowing who Lou was at that time, I knew that he was special just from the way Lance Russell would talk about him, you know, and because Lance even admits that, you know, I love that line, you know, when Lou passed away, there's a line in the Wrestling Observer when Meltzer reached out to get some quotes from people. And Lance says, you know, I guess I looked up to Lou so much, I never thought that he could die. And just, you could just tell that whenever Lou was in the ring, just the reverence that Lance had for him, that you knew that he was somebody special. And actually, they did when Lawler was on the shelf, you know, everybody talks about 1980 when the Lawler broke his leg, and, you know, and crowds were down. If you look at it overall, consistently crowds are down, but I think Jerry Jarrett worked harder than he ever had in his life that year to try to put together some intriguing matchups. And they were really trying to get over that CWA title. And I think they had a match with Billy Robinson headlining versus Lou Thesz. And I think that drew almost 7,000 people, which was better than some of the cards that they were doing with Lawler on top before he broke his leg.
Yeah. Now, it was around this time period that they started working with the AWA. And there's a big show on August 21st, 78, drew 11,000 people, which had Lawler and Bontwinkle on top for the first time, for AWA world title. You had the High Flyers. You got Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzella in Memphis going over Frankie Lane and Mike Boyer, of course, Mike Boyette. Vern Gagne working Memphis against Eddie Sullivan. So the Bruiser was on the card. Even Nelson Royal was there as NWA World Junior Champion. But, yeah, this is the beginning of their relationship with the AWA, but Memphis still had a kind of relationship still with the NWA, too. And that was a weird deal about Memphis, where you had, like, your Southern titles were AWA, and then you would have, like, maybe the Mid-America title when it showed up as was an NWA title. That was always interesting to me, how they balanced that out. But what did you think about when the AWA started getting involved?
Well, at the time, I didn't, you know, I started to read the wrestling magazines, and I knew that in my eyes, there were the three world champions, you know, Harley Race, Nick Bockwinkel, and Bob Backlund. And I didn't know that the NWA was, I didn't know which one was better than the other, you know, although I thought, I love, you know, dude, I'm a big belt mark. And I always thought, I mean, I always loved the NWA world title, but, you know, the fact that Bockwinkel is more like this big turkey platter, you know, like this huge belt. And he looked so regal, you know, to me, he fit the role of the world champion better than anybody during that era, and including Ric Flair, because, you know, as much as I love Ric Flair, you know, Ric always came across to me as a wrestler who is trying to look like a rich playboy. Nick Bockwinkel just, he just exuded that, and he just seemed like a legit, you know, rich California snob. Who just happens to be the best wrestler on the planet.
Yeah, I always said that he looked like he just got off playing the tennis courts at Beverly Hills Country Club, and he would, you know, just drove his, you know, Mercedes convertible to the studio, you know.
Yeah. right. Absolutely. Yeah, it's almost like he just happens to be the greatest wrestler in the world. And there's interviews where you have to pull out dictionaries to kind of decipher them, and and such a tremendous contrast of he and Lawler. You know, you have the rich champion, and then you have the blue collar guy from the South trying to get the belt. And, you know, all of these factors, I discussed this later with Jerry Jarrett, because I was insanely curious about why he switched from, you know, for the longest time, it was the NWA Southern title and NWA Southern Tag Champions, and the NWA champion would come in, you know, probably three times a year. And he basically said that he had gotten frustrated because he wanted to get Lawler a run with the NWA world title, and, you know, was trying to get Eddie Graham on his side. And they kept coming back, and they would, you know, the NWA board would say, well, we just don't feel like he's tough enough. And Jerry Jarrett would say, well, what do you mean tough? This is show business. And they're like, yeah, but if he got into a situation, he wouldn't be able to defend himself or the title. And I think at that, and I think in their eyes too, that Memphis was too crazy a territory. I think they maybe thought that, and probably rightfully so, that, that they would do like some quickie title changes that weren't authorized.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of stuff, which was later on, they actually did kind of do with the AWA titles. But plus too, I think, and I don't think Jerry Jarrett was, you know, when he looked at it, I think he figured, okay, I only have to convince one man, not an entire NWA board. And if I build this close relationship with Vern Gagne, eventually I'm going to talk him into letting Lawler have a run with it. And that was the initial idea behind it. And it just so happened too. And that Jarrett was so taken with Bockwinkle that he never bothered to really bring in, you know, they had one deal with Flair when Flair came in 82, and they didn't even bring him back to finish the angle, because Jarrett looked at Bockwinkle as being the best guy to play the role of the world champion. And really, you know, during my time as a fan, my friends and I, we viewed Nick Bockwinkle as the world heavyweight champion.
And that's definitely understandable because of where you're at, what's being, you know, portrayed on the show, and Nick Bockwinkle, you know, portraying himself in that way, you know, as the world heavyweight champion. And him and Lawler, for the next, 7 years, would just have some of the best matches in the history of the promotion, no doubt. Now, Lawler, at the end of the summer, going into the fall of 78, Lawler's still having problems with LeDuc and Jean-Louis, decides to bring back one of his old friends. The Mongolian Stomper was a partner of Jerry Lawler. They had steel cage match and this, that, and the other. And, of course, Stomper would turn on Lawler. But what do you think of the Mongolian Stomper? That's a guy, another guy who doesn't get talked about enough these days.
Well, you know, you asked me about my start as a fan. I should back up. I became a diehard fan in 77, but in 76, I remember, you know, my dad would watch wrestling, and he would make us turn off our cartoon. You know, I wanted Foghorn Leghorn. He wanted Lance Russell. You could say that there are too many differences between the two. but anyway, and the first memorable thing that I remember about wrestling was that the Stomper was in there with somebody. They were showing a clip from the Mid-South Coliseum. And the Stomper, they were doing a pull-apart brawl where it may have even been Lawler, I don't know. But Stomper's like beating on a guy, and all these wrestlers from the back came in to try to subdue him, and he was tossing them off like he was the Incredible Hulk. And I was floored. I was like, wow. You know, this guy's like a living, breathing supervillain. And just, you know, and there was just something about his eyes, too, that just, just standing there and not saying a word. He just looked like the most evil guy walking the planet.
Oh, yeah. Gorgeous George Jr. is his manager. He had that headgear on. He just looked like a complete psychopath. You know, he had a great look. Just big guy in shape. Just a scary, scary dude. Oh, man.
Well, and I think they did it. I think they had Bearcat Wright as his manager at one point in Memphis in the 70s. And then something happened, and Bearcat had to leave the territory, and somebody had the idea of Stomper doing his own promo. And at that point, he had lived in the South so much that he had actually kind of picked up a Southern twang, and it just about killed the gimmick. They had to take him off, you know, take him out of the territory and bring him back like about a year later.
Yeah, that happened. I think somewhere else too, if I remember right, that they actually let him speak, and that was, you know, a big detriment to his gimmick. You don't do that. I mean, the guy, you know, it's just not the same after that.
Well, and probably one of the most unusual, if you look at some of the card lineups, one of the most unusual main events you'll ever see that didn't take place and was never going to take place. But Stomper and Lawler, at some point in 78, were booked against Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzell for the AWA World Tag Titles.
Oh my God!
But you know, that was the card that appeared in the Memphis. That was the card that appeared in the Memphis newspaper on the Friday before the Saturday show. And so, you know, you go into the Saturday show thinking that that's going to be the main event, and that's the day that they shoot a breakup angle with Lawler and the Stomper, and Stomper gets Lawler's crown and crushes it, and Lawler comes out there and he's all, you know, Lawler's on the verge of tears, going, you know, and you can do anything you want to me, but that's the crown that Sam Bass gave me.
Oh. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah, and then they were off and running.
Oh yeah, but it didn't last long though, because Stomper was in and out not too long after that, and they had to come up with a new heel deal, and they turned Jimmy Valiant heel, like you said, on that one TV show where they debuted his music video. And if you've never seen that, that's been widely circulated, that show and that promo. And Lawler says some what these days would be a politically incorrect term to call you, he calls Jimmy Valiant Wayne Ferris, but this was Wayne Ferris's first big push here as Jimmy Valiant's understudy, and that angle was a hot angle. And what do you think about Wayne Ferris and how he, how he, basically grew up in just this short time span?
Yeah. I think that they had done a deal where Valiant had taken Ferris under his wing, because I think the story was that, Ferris being Lawler's cousin, that Lawler wasn't, he wanted Wayne to make it on his own. So they did a deal where, as a babyface, Valiant took Wayne under his wing, and they bleached his hair blonde and was training him. And then so when they did the split with Lawler and Valiant, they just went into a wild feud with Lawler and Dundee versus Valiant and Ferris.
Yeah, the thing is about that one is they only went two matches at the Coliseum. That's it.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it drew. Oh, did it?
One did 4,192, and the other one has a questionable attendance. But I think not long after that,
I think they turned Valiant back. I mean, he turned so many times in Memphis. I think that may have been a reflection. The fact that match didn't draw, that may have been a reflection that the fans didn't want to hate Valiant.
Oh yeah, definitely. And the deal with Valiant was I think the main reason why they kind of blew it off quickly was he was about to go back to WWF. Because he went there in January, when the Valiants went back, when him and Johnny at first went back, then they made Jerry Valiant. So I think that may have been why they stopped it quickly. And another reason why the man stopped it quickly was a new blonde guy was coming in. As on December 11, 1978, a man named Austin Idol made his debut in Memphis, beating Robert Gibson in the opening match at the Mid-South Coliseum. And Austin Idol would become one of the most legendary figures in the history of the promotion.
And that's around the time that I attended my first show at the Coliseum. That was in January of 79, which was Lawler and Jackie. Memphis always treated legends the absolute best possible way. They could always count on, if they brought Jackie Fargo in and he wrestled every week, it wouldn't mean much, but it was always like when Lawler was in a jam, and there was no other active wrestler he could turn to. He didn't need a wrestler. He needed somebody who could fight, and nobody could fight better than Jackie Fargo. And so for a big stretcher match, they had Lawler and Fargo against Austin Idol. And again, showing you just how Memphis was unusual and in its own world, they brought Mil Máscaras in as a heel.
Yeah.
And I, at that point, I had seen Mil and Dusty, and I mean, Mil was on the cover of nearly every wrestling magazine, and always he was always number one or number two most popular, either right in front of Dusty or right after Dusty. And so for Memphis to bring him in as a heel was just crazy.
Oh yeah, and yeah, that's one of those deals that it's just only in Memphis,
Right.
Only in Memphis would you see something like that.
And I know that Aaron Rodriguez has that reputation of not being cooperative and not selling and not just being a kind of a pain in the ass to work with. But he sold his ass off for Lawler and Fargo, and they hauled his ass out on a stretcher. And then Fargo ran down the aisle and turned the stretcher over and kept putting the boots to him. And he had to crawl back to the dressing room. And I asked him, and then when I told that story to Cornette, and he goes, oh, that wasn't Aaron Rodriguez. That was Pepe Lopez under the hood.
Now,
and I said, well, I said, look, I know that Memphis played tricks. You know, they would have Mr. Wrestling, and they would show, have photos of Tim Woods under the mask, but it was actually Dick Steinborn underneath there. So they all, and they had a mask superstar, but it wasn't Bill Eadie. It was Jerry Stubbs.
Mm-hmm.
I asked Jerry Jarrett about it. I said, was that really Aaron? Was that the Emil Mascaraz? Was that Aaron Rodriguez? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, how did you get him to do that? And he said that he goes, yeah, I was concerned with the same thing. He said, but we both knew a promoter in Mexico that I had befriended, and I had stayed at his house, and we were telling stories about him. And he had also stayed at this guy's big house in Mexico. And right before, he said about an hour before they were about to go, he goes, Jerry, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, I know what I would like you to do. And he said, well, I'll do anything you want. And so he laid it out for him. And I don't know if it was just because, and Jerry Jarrett assured him that they weren't going to tape it and show it on TV. And it seemed like one of those deals, maybe in hindsight, where maybe Mascaraz was just like, you know what, I'm just going to have fun with it. I'm just going to go out there and I'm going to be a heel and I'm going to sell my ass off for these two Southern legends.
That's amazing. And that's again, another Holy Grail type match there. Man, that sounds awesome. And I know. Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, Idol won the Southern Heavyweight title on Christmas of 78.
Yep.
And went into his champion. I don't know if maybe weather had a lot to do with some of the houses, but the houses were not very strong. And they actually took the title off of him. Again, Ron Fuller became Southern Heavyweight champion. That was interesting when you see Ron Fuller comes in at this time period. Roberts coming in later, and then you start seeing Jarrett Welch Promotions,
mm-hmm.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't know the whole deal with Buddy Fuller. He would become a prominent figure, but it became, instead of Jarrett Promotions, it became Jarrett Welch Promotions pretty much. What'd you think of the Fullers when they would come through in 79?
I remember being a fan of Robert Fuller, and he and Dundee were a team, and they had a feud with the Assassins, who they had a thing in the Memphis program that claimed that they were Pittsburgh Steelers linemen who were wrestling during the off season, which I totally bought, black and gold, and I was actually a big Steelers fan, so I was trying to figure out who they were. But Ron Fuller never did it for me, and I never quite got it. And I think the deal with Fuller getting the belt was because Lawler, I think Lawler was legit injured. I think that was when that deal where Idol kicked him in the stomach, and he nearly potatoed him with a kick, and Lawler had internal bleeding and passed out of an airbag. He told me later, years later, he thought he was dying.
Wow.
And so I think that was I think Lawler was booked to appear, and he couldn't make it, so they brought Ron Fuller in as a sub, and I guess just to appease the crowd, they had Fuller go over. But I'm not certain about that.
And yet
it started, the card started to take on a real Southeastern feel to it.
Yes, it did.
But I don't know I'm not sure what happened, if a communication problem with guys working Southeastern and Robert Fuller took the book around that time.
Well, there you go.
But there were a lot of no-shows during that time period. You would have guys like Tortanaka Bill, and he wouldn't make it, but then he would, he might be there the next week. I think Boris Malenko was booked. They started bringing in Jimmy Golden and guys like that. So it almost suddenly seemed like the Memphis and Southeastern territories were almost one and the same, really.
Yeah, and this was right before the split, too, in Southeastern.
Right, right. And so they did – I think Jerry Jarrett tells the story that the houses had they had this van tournament, right, where for months it was like you had to – win matches to, and it seems silly now, to quality, you had to win months of matches to even qualify to get into the tournament to win a van. a Cadillac is one thing, but just some tricked out 70s van.
That's a Fuller staple. Like in Southeastern, right. They did that every year. And that was just one of the things that was a Fuller booking statement. Yeah, that's what that was all about.
Yeah, and so to give you an idea, so the final of it, after months and months of buildup, drew 4,700 people, with oddly enough, Fuller going over the Stomper. And Lawler was so disinterested in it, I guess he has to be eliminated in the first round.
That's an interesting show, because there's a couple names on there that didn't really work Memphis that much, but I'll get to in a second. Bob Armstrong was coming in some here. They said Jimmy Golden. Don Carson's here with Dennis Condrey as his new partner, the Big C's. You're starting to see some of these, some different names coming in and out. And Memphis.
And then it all abruptly stops in June. And that's when they do the infamous Tupelo concession stand brawl.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And real quick, you mentioned the Assassins. Folks, this was not Tom Ernesto and Jody Hamilton. This would have been
Dirty Rose.
Dirty Rose and Don Bass.
I think it's Dirty Rose. I'm pretty sure it was them.
Yeah, Dirty Rose and Don Bass. So, which they would become, Fire and Flame years later, and the A Team and Assassins again, and yeah, they took on different characters. Throughout their run in Memphis. And, I mean, Kevin Sullivan was in Memphis this time as a babyface working a little bit. Buzz Sawyer was in Memphis as a babyface at this time period with the curly afro, white man fro going on when he had hair. And then, you're seeing all this stuff here. And Lawler and Idol have a big match. The big blow-off hair versus Loose Leaf Town Steel Cage match, April 23rd. Only drew 6,319 fans. And Lawler sent Idol packing.
Yeah.
That's interesting that it didn't draw more, because I guess maybe that was an indictment on Idol, because you look at Idol's shows that he was on, and there weren't a whole lot of big houses in this time period. It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't quite know what was missing there, because Idol was, it quickly became one of Lawler's favorite opponents. So I'm not sure what was that. It may have just been a fact that they were trying something new with Robert Fuller and the TV wasn't as strong. There's not a lot of that 78 stuff available. And as a kid, I'm not really dissecting it. I'm just, into the personalities and into the promos and that kind of stuff. So to me, it was all gold. But it could be that fans weren't responding to Fuller's TV programs.
And then you look at the next week, the main event is Southern Tidal, Mongolian Stomper, now champion, against Tommy Wildfire Rich, who at this time is really starting to make his name on Turner Television. Only drew 4,000 people, and Tommy was a guy who would was a Memphis guy. And it seemed like whenever they would bring him in for shots, he didn't draw.
Right.
Why do you think that was?
I'm not sure. I mean, I remember my sister being like a huge Tommy Rich fan. I'm not sure if it was looked at like he, like Lawler stayed in the territory. And the best thing that Tommy Rich ever did was leave Memphis.
Oh, absolutely.
But I don't know if it was maybe because the fans looked at it like he deserted them, went to Atlanta and then never came back, or would only come in on a kid. It was rare that he came between 80 and 83. He maybe came in three times, I think.
Yeah.
I'm talking about after the aborted heel turn. They had the heel turn where, the crowd at that point I think was just ready for Lawler to come back, and it had been like 9 months, and they turned Tommy babyface, and just when Tommy was starting to get hot again as a babyface, he left.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Two completely different type of guys start showing up in Memphis in May. Thunderbolt Patterson and this young blonde haired muscle head named Terry the Hulk Boulder. Now, first off, thoughts on Thunderbolt Patterson showing up in Memphis, and thoughts on the young Terry the Hulk Boulder.
Well, the only thing about Patterson that earlier, he wasn't here long, and then he actually no-showed about, I think he and Lawler were supposed to go against Tanaka and Fuji for the Southern Tag Belt, and they did this, you know, Thunderbolt doing his typical promo where he's like, you know, looking into the Lawler's eye and grabbing his hands and holding his hands and like talking about what they're going to do and like, ooh, and all this kind of stuff. And Thunderbolt ends up no-showing and Dutton takes his place. And the following week, Lawler comes out and just buries Thunderbolt. He goes, you know, when I was there last week with Thunderbolt, I'm not sure what happened to him, but, you know, I thought he was more interested in making moves on me than he was doing any kind of.
And then Terry the Hulk Boulder.
And of course, Lance is always like, all right, Jerry.
Oh, come on, Jerry.
And that's actually, that clip's on YouTube. But,
yes, it is.
I wish that the clip of Lawler, the actual clip of Thunderbolt and Lawler doing that was out there, but it's not. But yeah, I don't really remember too much of Thunderbolt just because he wasn't around much. But the Hulk, on the other hand, you know, that video that they did I'm trying to think of the guy's name, Randy West. Randy West and, yes, and Jerry Jarrett put together that promo video, you know, which just the whole doing he's all greased up and doing the poses and, you know, and Michael St. John doing the, you know, who later did the Kamala video going, you know,
Kamala.
Legs like tree trunks. Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. But at the end, you know, he just goes, the Hulk, the Hulk. and at that time, I think the Hulk TV show, the Lou Ferrigno show, was really hot. I was really into Marvel Comics. You know, my big interest, I was really popular with the girls, as you might imagine. My interests were wrestling and comic books.
And nothing wrong with that.
And so, yeah. So I absolutely loved the Hulk. I thought he was great, and he had his, you know, they had to limit his moveset because he was so green, to pretty much, you know, punches, arm drags, body slams, the leg drop, which was not his finisher. His finisher was a bear hug called the Super Southern Squeeze,
which would become the Golden Squeeze when he went to Georgia, Sterling Golden.
I didn't know he was using that was his finisher when he was in Georgia.
Yeah, I just put that I put up a Sterling Golden match on YouTube. I think it was yesterday, the day before yesterday as we record this. Him against a young, well, he wasn't young because he was always old, but a non-Golden Boy Chick Donovan. So, and he's, you know, using the Golden Squeeze on Chick Donovan.
Right.
And yeah, Hogan was green as grass, but he was here as a baby face, and he got over pretty good. You know, if you watch some of this stuff that's on YouTube of this era and see him on there, I mean, you see he's got potential. I mean, the guy looked like $1 million.
Oh yeah, yeah, and his promos weren't there yet.
Oh no,
but it was definitely like the beginning of the baby face role for him. And it's kind of funny. I mean, clearly when he went to Southeastern and even when he was in Georgia, you know, he and Idol's paths crossed.
Numerous
and, you know,
times.
People always talk about, people always talk about, you know, how he lit, about how Hogan lifted stuff from superstar Billy Graham. Well, of course, Idol was influenced by Graham as well. And Idol was always the one talking about Idol Mania.
Which exactly.
Which without a doubt led to Hulkamania.
Oh yeah, and that's a thing that I've been trying to put out there lately with these videos I put on YouTube of Idol. Idol is an early template of Hulk Hogan as far as like that persona as a babyface, most definitely. There's something to that.
One thing I love about Austin Idol, I'm watching some of the clips you posted on YouTube, and you know when he's he's out there and he's just like, you know, talking about how great he is and saying dolling this and dolling that. And the look on Gordon Sully's face, it's just like a classic Jack Benny deadpan look. You know, he's got this awesome. Oh, it's just great stuff. I mean, some people weren't exactly the biggest Gordon Sully fans, but I thought Gordon was tremendous.
Yeah, he was great in his role, no doubt. Although not that great in Memphis when he made the appearance in the studio in 1984.
Yeah.
It didn't fit.
It wasn't a good fit, no.
And that's the way it was with wrestlers, too. You know, there's some wrestlers couldn't adapt. You know, some announcers couldn't adapt. Now, what?
You know, Jimmy Hart likes to tell the story. He claims that they were talking about Terry Bolder and that Jimmy Hart said that he thought that Hulk was going to be a big star one day, and Lawler said, oh, that kid's never going to draw a dime. And, you know, Lawler may have said that, but I will say, I mean, Memphis was pushing him pretty hard.
Oh,
yeah. He, you know, he worked second from the top with Ron Bass for the Southern title and with Dundee headlining against Bockwinkle. He and Lawler, I think, headlined a main event against the Stomper and Gorgeous George Jr. So they clearly saw something in that kid.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Who couldn't? Exactly. Now, about guys who could have adapted, you mentioned that Van tournament. There was a guy in that Van tournament who this was maybe one of the one or two, definitely one, but I think he only made a couple other appearances in Memphis. Other than that, is Dick Slater. Dick Slater, I mean, just imagine if he had a run in Memphis, how that could have gone. You know, that guy was awesome.
He would definitely be, you know, I think I mentioned briefly like a short list of guys who I would have loved to have seen Lawler have an extended run with in Memphis, but it, for whatever reason, just never happened. And Dick Slater had a couple of matches with Dundee, but never, you know, never was there for TV, you know, never got a big push, but he would have been a tremendous fit for Memphis, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's a new tag team in the area, one who is making his return in Wayne Ferris, and he has a tag team partner with him, Larry Latham, and they are the Blonde Bombers, and they start a feud with Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee, and this, of course, is the leading to the first ever Tupelo Concession Stand brawl, and you know, one of the most legendary moments in Memphis history. And what was it like watching that on television? Because this is something like you would never see on wrestling in that era, something like this.
Yeah, I thought it was incredible. And actually, I think my aunt and uncle recorded that show, and they had a beta player.
Beta, yeah.
So they had that show on tape at their house. And so after that, I remember kind of like asking my mom, can I go stay at Aunt Barbara and Uncle Robert's house? Because I probably watched that thing, you know, probably 50 times. I thought it was absolutely tremendous. And Lance Russell is so great about selling how crazy this is, you know, when they're trying to get the, you know, they haven't sorted it out in advance how they're going to shoot it. They're having trouble even getting the camera down there. And Lance is like, you know, they leave it in where Lance curses, you know, he's like, God damn it. Touch my damn course cut. We got a hell of a fight going on down here. And it just added to the realism of it. And if you see, like, you know, it's kind of interesting watching the fans around what's left of the concession stand as they just absolutely destroy it. To some of the reaction that the fans just looking on in horror. And there's actually a woman, I believe, a blonde woman who's screaming hysterically during this thing. And she, I think, was the one who ran the concession stand. And they, I guess they had run it past them. They knew that the promotion told them that something, that they would like to shoot something that may happen. But they had no idea what they were getting themselves into.
Yeah, the story goes that she wasn't clued in on it. Yeah,
right. Yeah, she didn't. She had no idea like what it was going to be that insane. And they just, man, they absolutely just beat the shit out of each other.
Oh God, yeah,
without a doubt. I mean, it was all designed. Jerry Jarrett was desperate to spark the houses. You know, I mean, the crowd had dipped below 4,000, I think, for that Tommy Rich match against the Stomper. And I think that was Robert Fuller's, that may have been Robert Fuller's last night. And then suddenly it's, you know, kind of a, all the Southeastern guys are gone. Lawler and Dundee versus the Bombers, and they headlined for maybe like 6 weeks straight, I think.
Yeah, I mean they did a pretty much all of June and into July, and they had
and a then they started, run. And then they started planting the seeds for Lawler's hill turn.
Oh yeah, now real quick before we get to that, also in this time period in Memphis is something that basically if you look at all the territories. You know, you would see got sons of promoters and, you know, but it wasn't, you know, maybe like one a territory or something like that of a big name. In Memphis this time period, hell, you have three. Ricky Morton, Ken Wayne, and a young guy named Tommy Gilbert Jr. Of course, we know is Eddie Gilbert. And all three of these guys are like really start getting their starts at this time period. And that had to be pretty cool to see. You know, the sons teaming with the fathers, because all the fathers are still active, Buddy Wayne, Tommy Gilbert, and Paul Morton's referee. But, you know, you're seeing these guys around, you know, that had to be pretty cool as a young guy to see, you know, see these guys who are not much terribly older than you are, you know, starting to, you know, get their names out there on the horizon.
Yeah, and I think in the back of my mind, it was already starting to plant that seed too. That the way to break into the business is through journalism, because I would always pick up the wrestling, which I later did, but I would always pick up the wrestling news. And of course, you know, Jim Cornette always had photos and stories there, but also, you know, Tommy Gilbert Jr., Eddie Gilbert, was taking photos and trying his hand at writing stories. And then to see him get his break, I was like, ah, that's how you do it.
There you go.
And thinking less, you know, and not realizing, well, the bigger factor is probably that he's, you know, the son of a wrestler.
Yeah.
But I just thought, you know, if you got close to the business somehow and got in, that you could finagle your way to getting somebody to train you, you know, because I think at that point, Lawler's story about how he got into being a disc jockey and befriending Jackie Fargo and that whole thing, I think that story had kind of started to circulate around then too. And the great thing about, you know, Ken Wayne and Ricky Morton and Eddie, you know, pretty much from the get-go, were pretty darn good workers. I mean, they had grown up around it. And then they did that tremendous, real personal feud with the father-son feud with Buddy Wayne and Ken and Tommy and Eddie. And they do that deal where, you know, and first of all, I love Buddy Wayne.
Oh, I love Buddy Wayne.
Oh, my gosh. But Buddy comes out there and he apologizes, I think, to Tommy. And then, of course, you know, they jump him and they handcuff Tommy to the ring post. And then they just beat the shit out of Eddie and bust him open and the whole thing. And Tommy can't get loose and he's forced to watch.
Amazing. Yeah, that's great.
Oh, and so, you know, you had this great feud right out of the bat for Tommy or for Eddie and Ken. Kind of built on the strength of the promos with Tommy and Buddy Wayne.
Yeah. And speaking of promos, also at this time period is a new tag team in the territory. Terry Gordy and Michael Hayes, the Fabulous Freebirds. And if you haven't seen the introductory promo of the Freebirds in Memphis, you got to go on YouTube and find it, where Terry Gordy does most of the talking and does a good job. People don't know that Terry Gordy could talk. And Michael Hayes is standing there with a towel over his head, and they pulled a towel off, revealing a guy who looked like David Lee Roth. And Lawler and Dundee in the ring. Lawler had his perm going at this time period, looking like Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch. And what a segment, what a promo it was. And the Freebirds, they exuded cool right off the bat to me. What did you think about when the Freebirds showed up?
Oh, I absolutely loved them. And the night that they headlined against Lawler and Dundee, which is the story, you know, Hayes always tells that story about the first time they used entrance music. That was one of those shows where I begged my uncle to take me to the matches. As a kid, we lived out in the suburbs, which a lot of, you know, if you were the kid of a baby boomer, you didn't actually live in the city of Memphis. You probably lived in Bartlett or Germantown or something like that. And so it was difficult to talk my father into taking me, but my uncle kind of wanting to be the cool uncle would be the one who maybe four times a year I would get to go to the matches. And I was so into the Freebirds that that was one that was a match that I begged him to take me to go see. And that was the first night that the Freebirds came out to the music. And Hayes likes to tell the story that, you know, that they hit the music and all the, you know, the crowd stood, and he could just tell Lawler's face that Lawler was pissed because they had taken the spotlight away. And not too long after that, you know, Lawler started using music occasionally.
Yeah, and Hayes and Gordon weren't working with Lawler anymore after this. They beat the Freebirds in that one match.
and that could have been a tremendous program.
Oh yes.
You know, but you had, I think at the same time you still had Latham and Ferris who were already over. And it was just more of a, I think there was maybe some jealousy about the music thing. They were starting to turn them babyface, and then they turned them back heel with no explanation, and didn't really have anything for them to do. But I just can't help but think if maybe Latham and Ferris hadn't come to the territory, that maybe Gordy and Hayes would have gotten that spot, and that program with Lawler and Dundee would have been unbelievable. You know, because shortly after that, you know, I think they went from there to Mid-South and really started to take off.
Yeah, the rest is history there for sure.
Yeah,
and that same night, you mentioned Latham and Ferris. They're working in a handicap match with Danny Davis, their manager, of course, Nightmare Danny Davis, who was working as a manager this time period, against Jackie Fargo and his brother Roughhouse Fargo. And if you've seen Jump Rock Promotions TV matches from the early 80s, you see a guy who is a referee who wears like yellow pants and yellow shirt, or maybe blue pants and a blue shirt, mustache, gray-haired guy, as Sonny Fargo. Well, he had an alter ego in Memphis as Roughhouse Fargo. And you mentioned like how Lawler would bring in Jackie sometimes to be that enforcer, that guy who you needed. Well, Jackie would do that with Roughhouse, and you gotta describe the people, the Roughhouse Fargo gimmick. I mean, it is amazing.
Well, it would always be like Fargo doing one of those great, you know, I loved Fargo's promos. They were just so crude and unpolished, and sometimes he would stumble over himself, but that just added to the seriousness of it, especially, you know, when he's all pissed off. And, you know, so what would typically happen? Like Lawler would be at his wit's end, and he would bring in Fargo, which I think was the case with this with the Ferris and Latham. And then if Fargo got overwhelmed, then he would come out and go, you know what? I underestimated you guys. We need more backup. So I'm going to Bolivar. I'm going to the Nut House. And he would check out his brother for a 3-day pass. Locked up in the Bolivar Nut House. And they would let him out of his street jacket for 3 days, and he would come out there and he would just go absolutely, you know, and the guy, you know, weighed less than 200 pounds, looked like your next door neighbor, but he was over as just the biggest maniac. And he's punching Ferris, Latham, they're bumping big time. Davis is bumping all over the place. And then he turned around and hit the referee, and then he turned around and hit Jackie too. So he's just, you know, he's hitting everybody. But yeah, it's kind of funny to see the playing the mild mannered referee in Crockett Promotions and then coming to Memphis, and he's over as like one of the most crazy guys to ever hit the ring.
Yeah. Now Lawler would turn heel in late 79 in the fall era against Dundee. And that was interesting because Lawler was so over as a babyface at this time period. And you know, you thinking that, you know, this guy's just going to be, you know, the top guy forever as a babyface. And he turns with Dundee, and this is where Jimmy Hart becomes a presence on the scene. What did you think of that whole turn and Jimmy Hart's emergence as Jerry Lawler's manager?
Well, that was my first experience of being a heel fan, and it kind of being cool to cheer for the heel because – there's a little bit of foreshadowing going on. Like I actually have some photos from that night that Lawler and Dundee worked with the Freebirds at this guy sent me years later. He had been reading my Kentucky Fried Wrestling site, and I talked about that night, and he was there with the, I guess, the WFIA convention, and he happened to shoot some photos that night, and I put them up on my website. So, and in those photos, this is like weeks before the heel turn, the outline of Lawler's crown-shaped goatee is starting to come in. You know, he was clearly growing back the goatee for the heel run,
yeah,
which I thought was just tremendous, you know, and they, again, it's kind of showing how Memphis could book the world title and portray it as something important. Dundee had this really incredible match with Bockwinkel, and it ended inconclusively, and they're standing out there, and they're talking about their upcoming tag match, and Lance goes, but I have to say, talking about a match in the future, based on the match a couple of weeks ago, the AWA has ordered a rematch between Nick Bockwinkel and Bill Dundee, and that's coming soon down to the, and you can just see Lawler kind of going, you know, just kind of giving a little smirk, you know, and doesn't, you know, and just didn't really say anything, and then slowly it just sort of builds, right, the tension between the two, and then it just explodes. But the whole thing, you know, the reason why the friendship ended was because the world championship was hanging in the balance. So that was actually the first Lawler Bockwinkel match that I saw live. And it was interesting too to see that match because it kind of got to, even though the crowd wanted, you know, half the crowd was probably with Lawler, but he had just turned against Dundee and stolen the Southern title to get the shot at Bockwinkel. But the other crowd was getting with Bockwinkel, and it sort of became a deal where it was not about Lawler trying to beat Bockwinkel as time was running out. They went to the 60-minute Broadway, but that Bockwinkel couldn't finish Lawler off. Well, it was like Bockwinkel ended the match with the advantage. So it was really kind of an unusual match. It was also the first time that I'd ever seen Lawler, you know, because I guess now he's a heel, it doesn't work. He pulls the strap and goes for a punch against Bockwinkel to make his comeback. Bockwinkel blocks it, decks him, and Lawler sells big time for it.
Yeah, that's there's an interesting dynamic change is when you have Bockwinkel now basically working as a babyface against Lawler in the title matches, you know. But the fans are still cheering Lawler, though, I'm pretty sure. So a good chunk of them, you know, just because he turned, they turned against him all the way.
Yeah, because it was sort of that deal, too, where it was like, he's a heel, he's an asshole, but he's our asshole, yes. And we want to see him get the world title.
It was also this time period that they created their own world title. The CWA World Heavyweight title, and Pat McGinnis, I think, was the first champion, but the guy that beat him was Superstar Billy Graham, and that had to be a weird sight to see, you know, the guy that has been main event in Madison Square Garden for a couple of years there, one of the biggest stars in the business, and here he is working in Memphis.
Right, I mean, and to me, I mean, that gave a lot of, if they were going to try to create this world champion, I don't know why they had Pat McGinnis come in as champion if the plan was to have Graham hold it to give it some kind of credibility, and it was strictly because of the fact that he had been headlining Madison Square Garden, and he had, you know, and as a kid, I'd seen him all over the magazines, so there's no doubt that he was over as a star in my eyes, but I wasn't buying the whole CWA title. You know, first of all, when it first debuted, it was a big trophy. They didn't even have the belt made yet. So for all I knew, it could have been one of Eddie Marlin's bowling trophies. I mean, you know, can you imagine? It would be a curse to win this thing. You'd have to lug it all over the world. I believe I was there the night that Billy Graham beat McGinnis in an arm wrestling contest, which earned him a world title.
That's right, yeah.
And then Graham got it. But I remember, you know, Bockwinkel was still sort of coming into the area too. And so I remember when they switched the title at Rupp Arena, I guess to kind of get over the fact that, the title is defended all over the world, including Kentucky. so switch it there instead of Memphis. But I think that was on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, and that was the lead sports story, you know, with Jack Eaton on Channel 5. And I didn't see the report, but my dad called. My dad was a firefighter, and he called from the fire station, And so he's on the phone. He said, "You're not going to believe this." I said, "What?" He goes, "Lawler just won the world title." And I went, "He beat Bockwinkel?" And my dad goes, "No, somebody named Billy Graham." And I went, "Oh, yeah, okay, cool." But, you know, I, even as a 8-year-old, you know, I wasn't buying this whole new world title because I hadn't seen it in the magazine, and it couldn't be that important if it wasn't listed in the aftermath.
Yeah, and Graham was, you know, he wasn't the same guy either as he was in WWF as well. And I think part of the reason why they did that change in Lexington may have something to do with ICW was getting started at that time period.
Well, and I think Jerry Jarrett kind of liked the, first of all, I think he envisioned Rupp Arena as being like the home of the Kentucky Derby and where champions are crowned, and I think he did want to give it that a little bit of that credibility that the title switch didn't happen in Memphis, it happened in Lexington. And I even asked him about the creation of the world title and what was the purpose behind that. And he explained that he had talked with Vern Gagne about, you know, creating this separate championship and having Lawler and Bockwinkel, you know, feud over it, and that there was a possibility at least of Vern agreeing to doing a switch between the two, where Lawler would unify the titles, and then Bockwinkel would get it back. But there was like a loose arrangement to do that. And it was all about, they were going to have a deal where Lawler won the AWA world title. They're still going to hold on to the Southern Championship. And Lawler even sort of alludes to that in his first heel promo, that he's not relinquishing any of the titles, that he wants to win them all. And that was that. And it actually kind of came to fruition years later in 88, when he and Kerry Von Erich did that series and united the belts.
Yeah. And then they had a match on December 10th where they had title versus title and Bockwinkel won by DQ. So yep. They didn't pull the trigger then. Now, also December, you're seeing some new guys come to territory. And you talk about, you know, Memphis going to a serious route. You don't get much more serious than Billy Robinson. And
right.
Yeah, Billy Robinson was in Memphis pretty much for a whole year. And, God, what a great worker he was. I mean, he brought that realism to Memphis, didn't he?
Absolutely. And you know, even though he came in before Lawler got hurt, it was almost like he was sort of the ideal person to not replace Lawler, but to headline a lot of the cards, because they put the CWA title, which was actually a very inspired choice. I mean, if you're looking at some of the greatest workers of that era, like, you know, Briscoe, the Funks, and, you know, Bockwinkel and Race, and I mean, Robinson's name would definitely be in that conversation as a guy to get over a world championship. And like I said, I mean, he had some great, he defended against Luthez, and that drew well. And, but the fans were really into him, and he couldn't cut a promo to save his life, but he was so super smooth in the ring. He and Tony Charles had some great matches, that he got over in Memphis.
And then you look at, you know, Ken Lucas showed up at this time as well. Mm-hmm. And what do you think of Ken Lucas when he come in and formed this team with Ricky Morton?
Well, I remember they did a deal where Lawler cut an interview, and he was like going, "Yeah, they tell me I have to defend my world title against Ken Lucas. I don't understand it. I've never even heard of Ken Lucas. I know it." He's like, "He's just a bum. He's a nobody. I don't know what to tell you. I know you want me to act like this is a big match, but I don't have anything to say about him because I've never heard of him," which is not true, because they had teamed together, I think, in Nashville, you know, a couple of years before that. And then they go, "Okay, that was the before. Now let's go to the after interview, the post-match interview with Jerry Lawler." And they, you know, they do this deal where Lawler's face has been, you know, altered with makeup, but it looks like Ken Lucas has beat the shit out of him. He's got like bruises and black eyes and the whole deal. So Ken Lucas just came across as like a no nonsense tough guy, the kind of guy that would get over in Memphis and stay over.
Yeah, and he was a perfect antithesis for Lawler. You know, Lawler, yeah. You know, bringing this you know, the funny shtick and insults and stuff like that. And then there's straight ahead Ken Lucas. And I thought they had good chemistry together. And who knows what could have happened if Lawler wouldn't have got hurt, you know, involving him and Lucas. And another guy that's coming in, he comes as a babyface, but he would quickly turn as a Paul Ellering. And we mentioned green guys earlier, like Cherry the Whole Boulder, where Ellering was pretty green too. And it was a different Paul Ellering because he had, you know, brown hair and, you know, it was kind of jacked up. But what do you think about Ellering when he came through?
I wasn't into him at first. You know, and again, as a kid, you don't really, you know, obviously the guy was physically impressive. And you don't, as a kid, you don't really know what a good worker is, right? But you do know somebody who you can tell, like, when something's boring and when the guy's not really doing it for you. And I really wasn't into him at all. And they did that, man. And Jerry Jarrett, you know, it's so funny. Jerry Jarrett sees things in people. Like, you know, he saw something in Paul Orndorff when Orndorff was doing jobs in Florida for Eddie Graham. And he asked Eddie Graham, he's like, do you mind if I book this kid? He's like, no, I'm taking him. I don't have any use for him. He used Chick Donovan as a headliner. Chick got over in Memphis. You know, Chick, I think, never got a real shot anywhere else to headline. And again, he was the first one really to see something in Ellering, and something that where he could get over as a heel. And they did this perfectly too. They were talking about how Lawler was, this is right before Lawler broke his leg. And I guess he had defended against Ellering, defended the world title against Ellering, and Jerry Jarrett was out there saying, you know, I just, Lawler's really, he's got me where I'm having to sign these matches. He's got such control over his contract and who he defends his title against. He insisted on defending against Paul Ellering. And, you know, Paul just doesn't, he's not on the caliber of a Jerry Lawler. And didn't mean it, you know, mean-spirited or anything. And then Paul Ellering goes up there and goes, like, did you just call me a punk wrestler? And Jerry Jarrett's back and all. He goes, no, I wasn't saying that. I said, you just don't have the experience for a world title match against Lawler. You're just not ready for that. And it's just a matter of Lawler picking his opponent. He goes, no, you just called me a punk wrestler. He storms out. And then, you know, and then started doing these great heel promos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And yeah, he grew into his character. Now, one thing that started up here.
I think he called Lance Russell like Lance the Muscle Russell.
Yeah. The muscle was in his nose. The one thing we also see here is maybe, I don't know if I would say they were the first, but definitely the beginning of a thing that dominated Memphis wrestling in the 80s. The first of the Pretty Boy Babyface tag teams starts up here, Ricky and Robert Gibson. And, you know, people remember Robert Gibson as one half of the Rock and Roll Express with Ricky Morton. But him and Ricky Gibson, his brother, as a tag team in Memphis, you know, in their separate runs here in the early 80s, they were pretty damn good. What'd you think about the Gibson brothers?
Oh, man, I thought they were great. They had some great matches with the Cuban Assassin and Ali Hassan, I believe. I thought they were tremendous. And, you know, and Ricky was a little rougher around the edges than Robert. So it was actually kind of a nice contrast because Robert was younger and had that little bit more of a rock star look. And Ricky was just a little bit tougher. And Ricky had headlined against Lawler, you know, back in 76. And Ricky was a little bit more straightforward in his promos and kind of came off as more of a tough guy than a pretty boy. So it was a perfect match. But no, I thought they were super, super smooth in the ring.
Yeah, and they had a good feud with the Assassins at this time period, and of course, you mentioned Cuban Assassin Ali Hassan. Yeah, Ricky and Robert Gibson were a pretty strong tag team. And like I said, they began that early run of the Pretty Boy Babyface tag teams that Memphis would become legendary for. Then Jimmy Valiant shows back up here, and he's with Lawler as a heel with Jimmy Hart.
Right.
And that was pretty cool to see Lawler and Valiant together as heels this time. And you know that.
You know what's fun about that though is like the crowds were it was almost like too much of a good thing, you know, to have those two on the same heel side. I don't know if it. I don't know. I'm not sure what the reason was, but crowds like started to kind of dip around that time period where right before Lawler broke his leg, you know, the matches with where he was teaming. I think it was like Lawler teaming with Valiant and Hart in some 6-man tags against Jerry Jarrett and Ken Lucas and somebody else. But crowds had started to kind of dip, and I don't know if it was just because Lawler and Valiant just didn't belong on the same heel side. You know, you had to have one of them. Almost be a babyface or a heel, or maybe both babyfaces. But it was almost like the fans couldn't get into hating both of those guys at the same time. And then, of course, when Lawler breaks his leg, you know, almost immediately, Jerry Jarrett turns Valiant babyface to kind of pick up the babyface slack. And they actually did pretty well in 1980.
Now, what you mentioned that Jerry Jarrett was working around at the time. One thing that's interesting to note looking at the Memphis lineups is you don't see Jerry Jarrett working in Memphis. He's working in Louisville. He's working in some of the other towns. Mm-hmm. But why do you think he didn't work in Memphis at this time?
Well, I think that they used to explain it on TV that he felt like it would be a conflict of interest for him to – because I guess he was saying – I'm trying to remember this right – that there was maybe Buddy Fuller was promoter of the other towns, but as the promoter in Memphis, he thought it was a conflict of interest to book himself on cards. I believe that's the way he explained it on TV. And I think the personal issue between he and Lawler brought him out initially, and then when Lawler was gone, I think they did an angle on TV where he got jumped and beat up, and then he was back in the game, teaming with Tojo.
Yeah. Yeah, and that would come later on, I think in the year 1980. The last match that Lawler had in Memphis before his injury, he was teaming with Jimmy Valiant. They lost to Jackie Fargo and Bill Dundee by DQ. And then you had the injury. What was it like hearing about that injury and not an injury that didn't happen in a wrestling match that happened playing flag football with Jerry Calhoun?
Right. I remember the news clip on, because again, it was a big news story. And so, you know, Jack Eaton, they did a big feature on that on the Channel 5 news. And I was, you know, and I love Lawler's thing. He was saying, he goes, you know, every Sunday, some buddies of mine, really close friends, we get together and play some touch football, you know, Jack Lambert, Terry Bradshaw, the boys.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, he just had one of those things happen, but, I was pretty devastated because, like I said, even though Lawler was a heel, that was my first experience where I turned against Dundee because I kind of saw it Lawler's way, you know, that the world title was more important than a friendship. And so I was, you know, I was still rooting for Lawler even though he was a heel. So I was pretty disappointed that he had broken his leg. And I actually started to kind of tune out a little bit around this time period. But I think I did go to – I think what got me to beg my uncle to take me to the Coliseum – I'm trying to see the month here. It was when they brought back Rocky Johnson to be Valiant's partner. And I think that's what got me kind of like, okay, got me tuning back in after I kind of tuned out right after Lawler broke his leg.
Yeah, and that's what they had to do. They had to do damage control, basically. They turned Valiant back babyface again. So Valiant's babyface. They turned Ellering heel. And this is where Jimmy Harper claims Paul Ellering the new king. And this is an interesting deal to me. And it's you know, we talk about what-if scenarios in Memphis. You know, what if Lawler doesn't get hurt? And what then we see how would it affect Jimmy Hart? Because this is pushed now. Jimmy Hart is the lead heel, basically himself. He becomes the lead heel, and he manages everybody around him. But do we get Jimmy Hart as we know him if Jerry Lawler doesn't get hurt?
I don't. You know, it's interesting because you know the Hart. If you look at a lot of those interviews, well, first of all, there aren't a lot of them out there. But the interviews that you can find with Lawler and Hart. Hart rarely says anything, you know, it's almost like Lawler delivers the entire promo and Hart's just holding the CWA title. And then maybe he'll say something in passing as he, you know, into the mic as he's walking off back to the dressing room. But, you know, he was practically muzzled. I mean, he was almost, even though, as it turned out, Hart could talk, but, you know, Lawler had Mickey Poole as his manager, you know, who he back in, it was not exactly a rocket scientist. But, you know, that guy couldn't get a promo to save his life. So he really was kind of like, he really actually was a stooge for Lawler. But Hart, you know, there was a friendship there. But I think for whatever reason, I don't know if it was just because Lawler was so gold on the mic that he didn't feel the need to pass it to Jimmy Hart. But yeah, Hart rarely said anything during their interviews. So who knew that he could cut this great promo? I mean, you know, he had this tremendous energy. They say that, you know, he only slept like, he would only sleep like 4 or 5 hours a night, and that he was constantly on the go. And he kind of had that nervous energy that translated well for a heel manager. But I remember, you know, hearing Jimmy Hart talk how, you know, Jerry pulled him aside in Lexington. And that's, you know, and they were in Lexington, the home of the Kentucky Derby. And that's where the whole break your leg thing, because they were talking about a racehorse breaking his leg and what do you do to him and that kind of thing. And that's where Jarrett gave Hart the promo. And he told Hart, he goes, I'm going to put all the heat on you. And Hart just was off and running.
And it took him a little bit to get going. And he didn't have the greatest amount of talent around him. I mean, because, you know, Danny Davis was still managing the Bombers. So you had basically it was Hassan and Ellering was pretty much Jimmy Hart's guys. Because Dennis Condrey and Dr. D. David Schultz are on their own. And it wouldn't get going until later on in the year when you start seeing the beginnings of the first family. Now, you mentioned Rocky Johnson. Yeah, they brought Rocky Johnson in, the team of Valiant, and they became Southern Tag Team Champions. What do you think about Rocky Johnson when he came in? Because he had been around earlier, about 5 years earlier, four or five years earlier. And here he comes back, and I don't know. I've seen the stuff, you know, from this era, and it just didn't seem like it come off as a big deal. I mean, what'd you think about it, Rocky Johnson?
Oh no, I thought Johnson was cool. I mean, you know, as a kid, you know, you sort of, you know, Muhammad Ali was everywhere and kind of larger than life, and you know, in a comic book with Superman and that kind of thing. And here's a guy who looks, you know, it kind of reminds you of a boxer. And originally, of course, Jared did bring him in under the guise, you know, of saying that this was that Rocky wasn't a wrestler, that he was a boxer. And he and Lawler had, you know, like a 10, you know, packed, nearly sold out the Coliseum for a boxer versus wrestler match around the time that they were doing all that stuff with Inoki and Ali. And so I kind of looked at him sort of like that, kind of had that same kind of Ali cool factor, even though, I mean, and his promos were good. They weren't quite on the level of Ali. But no, I thought Johnson was cool, and somehow together he and Valiant just sort of seemed to go together.
Yeah, and also this time here we see Jerry Jarrett now starting to work the Memphis shows, teaming with Tojo Yamamoto, and so those two would always come back as a team here and there every now and then. But Tojo was a baby face. It just didn't feel right, did it? Tojo was always best as a heel to me.
Oh, he was over no matter what. You know, Cornette and I were talking about this. You know, the card where Idol brought in Mil Mascaraz, who's one of the biggest box office draws in the world, and on the cover of every wrestling magazine, but Idol brings him in to headline against Lawler and Fargo in a stretcher match. 6,700 fans. Well, you know, the story goes that Lawler and Fargo hurt Mascaraz and ran him off. And so the following week, with the same match, Lawler and Fargo, Idol says, okay, I'm going to bring in, you got rid of Mascaraz, I'm going to bring in Tojo Yamamoto. And the house jumps by like, you know, 1,500, 2,000 fans. Tojo was just, he was over as a heel or a baby face. And again, it's kind of like one of those, you know, people look at it and they go, how was this guy over? It's hard to explain, but he really could lay in the chops. His promos weren't polished, but they were believable. And he was just one of those characters that just kind of was endearing to Memphis fans.
Yeah. Now you look at going through 1980, you're seeing, you know, a lot of different mixing and matching of guys since Lawler's not around. But one match that stands out to me is July 28th at Mid-South Coliseum. In front of over 8,000 fans, Billy Robinson, now CWA champion, beats Bill Dundee by count out. The title was held up. The match went almost 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Billy Robinson, Bill Dundee for almost 30 minutes. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. No, I absolutely.
And then they come back the next week and do the match with Luthez as referee. And Dundee wins the title in over 36 minutes.
Right.
And now you're seeing us, and then they do it the week after, you know, the 11th, go almost 30 minutes again, where Robinson wins the belt back. So that's three weeks of matches right there, which, you know, sounds amazing. And then you're seeing some guys. Then, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and then to show you just how committed they were trying to get that CWA title, I guess at that point, Bockwinkle had dropped the AWA title to Vern Gagne in Chicago at Comiskey Park, and they bring him in to challenge for Robinson, and Robinson beats him.
So, yeah, he beats Bockwinkle.
Yeah, so they were really trying to, you know, to establish that championship in Lawler's absence. And really, I think the main reason why it's faded was because Robinson took the belt with him. and he, you know, Jerry Jarrett eventually got in touch with him and said, you know, I would really like to have the belt back. This was years later. He finally got in touch with Robinson because, you're going to think this is silly, but for sentimental reasons, I would like to have that belt back. And Robin says, oh, and my wife took it in the divorce.
Oops. Now, a couple of interesting tag teams show up in Memphis, you know, working some shots here. Austin Idol comes back with Dutch Mantel as his tag partner, and they win the CWA tag titles off Jerry Jarrett and Toji Yamamoto. And we get an appearance on August 11th. They defend those titles against Tony Atlas and Tommy Rich. And a rare Tony Atlas appearance in Memphis. I mean, that's a big time match there for the Coliseum, and only almost got 7,000 fans in there.
Yeah. I always kind of forget about Tommy coming in as a babyface before he turned heel. And Idol and Mantel, even though it was like sort of that oddball pairing, it just clicked. They were really over as a tag team.
And Dutch had been in there earlier, I mean, a few years earlier, and he comes in for this shot here, but he doesn't stay around long. But, you know, you can see that Dutch had the makings of one of those guys that could be a perfect guy for Memphis for a long-term run. I mean, he was ready for that. Now, we talk about Tommy Rich in the babyface turn. They do it on – I mean, the heel turn. They do it on television where he turns on Dundee and – how much of a shock was that to see a guy that had been, you know, the biggest babyface in the wrestling world on Turner Television turning this kind of like psychotic heel character?
Yeah, I remember watching that match live as a kid and just being absolutely shocked because even though Tommy had not appeared in the area regularly, I was buying every copy of the Wrestler, Inside Wrestling, and Pro Wrestling Illustrated that I could get my hands on. And he was all over the magazine, so I knew that he was a big star. For him to come back, and you know, and they kind of do that subtle, subtle deal where he headbutts Dundee in the groin on a backdrop, and then as he looks like he's helping Dundee up these small packages for the quick three count. I think too that was set up to not only turn Tommy heel. But I think they were expecting Lawler to come back sooner, and I think that was going to be the comeback match, Lawler against Tommy Rich, which, you know, you would have thought that would have been the biggest match in wrestling history because you've got Tommy Rich, who has been this incredible babyface on TBS, and you know, a lot of homes in Memphis were starting to get cable vision and seeing Tommy become this big star, and then you have him, you know, attacking Memphis' favorite son, who's sidelined with a leg injury. And so that would have been an incredible although the Dream Machine was a great choice, and we can get into that later, but that just would have been tremendous, I think. If the heel turn had really taken with Tommy and Lawler had been able to come back sooner like they thought.
Yeah, and you watch the television at the time period, and you see where, I mean, they definitely were trying to get Lawler back in there somehow, some way, and he does make an appearance on September 1st at the Coliseum. 7,600 fans, so not this mega house, and he beats Jimmy Hart. But still, he was only one leg, wasn't he?
Yeah, I don't think it was that. He did a match. It was like the unofficial comeback match. He did some kind of gimmick match with Carl Crew.
The next week,
I think that's where he re-injured the leg.
Yeah, he re-injured the leg.
Because I think he was supposed to come back. Yeah. Yeah, so and that kind of pushes the turn back to the end of December. And Krupp is one of those guys too. It's kind of, you know, just based on the look and the gimmick and his promos, you know, he was like a main event guy in Memphis, and I don't think was a huge star anywhere else.
Yeah, he was like a big star in like the Maritimes in Canada and stuff like that.
Right.
He would main event these. Odder territories, you know, got not your more untraditional territories, I guess you could say. And he was an interesting character, no doubt. Now, they give Tom Richards Southern title. He beats Valiant, and Valiant beats him the next week. So, 1 week reign for Tom Richards Southern champion at the moment. But he becomes the Memphis City champion. What was the story behind that? Because they would break that out every now and then, but what was the deal behind the Memphis heavyweight title?
You know, that's one thing that when I go back and I look at like old lineups of cards and I see that, I don't remember that at all. I sort of remember them alluding to it on the TV show, but I don't really. I think that was just one of those failed attempts to create another championship.
Yeah, pretty much. Which, you know, they had the CWA title, they had the Southern title, they really didn't need, and they have a new championship come in. It's also this time period they pretty much absorb the Gulas territory, and Bobby Eaton comes in as the NWA Mid-America champion, becomes a member of the First Family with Tommy Rich. And what are your thoughts of seeing Bobby Eaton here as a young heel?
At the time, I Bobby couldn't cut a promo, but just a lot, you could get away with not cutting a promo if you had Hart, because Hart had so much heat on him, especially by this time, getting toward the end of 1980, and just the simmering heat between Lawler and Hart, where Lawler would, you know, just about get his hands on him, but still still dealing with the leg injury. He might be able to punch Hart once, but can't really do what he wants to do and try to get him out of the business that he put him in. So I don't really, from a kid's viewpoint, I don't really remember much about Bobby, but there's no doubt when you go back and look at some of those matches, how good he already was at that point.
Yeah, and he formed a tag team with Tommy Rich, and they had some really good chemistry together with Hart. And this is when Hart's starting to come into his own as a manager in the fall of 80. And then they do this, they turn Jimmy Valiant in a deal where they had a battle royal on television for the TV title, yet another new creation. And Coco Ware wins the TV title and a television set. Well, Jimmy Valiant gets upset and breaks the television set.
And I was like, "Well, how is that supposed to work? Is he supposed to lug the TV from town to town?"
You're plugging in a different place.
I mean, I thought that was so ridiculous. A TV title with no belt, but you actually win a TV. A color TV, as I think they were.
Yeah, because Valiant broke one, and then they give Coco another one the next week, and Valiant breaks that one too.
Right. I forgot about that.
And then Tojo turns heel with him, so Valiant and Tojo are heels, and this all leads up to they bring out Peggy Rich, Tommy Rich's mom, who, you know, talks about how she just, you know, she's kind of disappointed in her son and what he's done, and they kind of put the blame on the fans in a way in the promo, where they're saying, well, when Tommy came back home, the fans just weren't treating him like, you know, that he was expecting and all this other stuff. And he felt like he you know, he had to do what he was felt was right and all this other crap. And then Valiant and Tojo come out there, and Valiant kind of roughs up Peggy, and then Tommy comes out, and if I'm not mistaken, wasn't Tommy wearing a white, something white?
Yeah.
So, of course, you know what that means. And that was a hot angle. What were your memories of seeing that angle?
It's funny, too, because Memphis was usually, if there was any kind of studio brawl or a sneak attack, the fans would really respond to it, with just screams, and the place would actually be going nuts. It was almost too much for the fans, I think, to take to absorb, because you had the number one heel, his mother coming out, and like you said, like giving the speech where it's kind of like blaming the fans, and Valiant, who at that point had, he had been a the biggest babyface going, suddenly he turns heel over a TV set. And I guess it's all because Lawler's about to come back. They have this plan where they feel like Tommy's not, that the fans don't hate Tommy, so they're going to turn him back babyface. So they've got to kind of leverage the heels and babyfaces on the roster. So I guess they decide, well, we'll turn Valiant, Tojo, and Tommy all in one show. And it just happened so fast that, Tommy's like, they're beating the shit out of Tommy. It looks like, my goodness, like the assassination in The Godfather with Sonny Corleone. just bleeding everywhere. And the crowd's not really into it. I think it was just one of those deals where it just wasn't clear what the hell was happening. Why is Jimmy Valiant picking on poor Coco Ware over a TV and suddenly just Tojo comes out there and he had been a baby face. Why is suddenly he coming out there with Valiant? The whole thing just didn't, it was too abrupt. Obviously as a kid, there's that much blood and that's shocking. But I remember just not really knowing what to think of it.
Yeah, so maybe too much at one time going on. Sensory overload maybe would have been for the fans of 1980. Seeing all this going on.
And it did, and the whole idea was to turn Tommy baby. I don't know about coming out and having his mother speak for him and almost like you said, like almost defending his behavior.
Yeah, blaming the fans for you. You're the reason why he turned. But at least Tommy turned babyface and reforming his tag team with Bill Dundee. And Bill Dundee and Tommy Rich had a really strong team in this era, feuding with the different champions and before Tommy went back to Georgia. And as you're saying, Tommy was starting to get hot again before he left. And as a credit to him.
Yeah. Well, and I think at that point, I think in February, he started taking bookings again in Georgia and was still kind of coming to Memphis. Actually, I think he and Lawler and teamed together in 1981, or like March 81. I think Dundee was injured, and so Lawler took Dundee's place, and he and Rich won the CWA World Tag Titles, which I think were then quickly forgotten. And then the next month, Tommy wins the NWA World Title, beat Harley Race. So kind of an odd situation. He was still, I think, working in Memphis, but only select dates, and was starting to get kind of entrenched in Georgia again.
Yeah. Now, December 15th. And a show that drew less than 3,000 fans, which was main evented by Tommy and Dundee beating Roger Kirby and Guy Mitchell by DQ for the Southern Tag Titles. Dream Machine makes his debut as a new heel charge for Jimmy Hart. And Troy Graham, he made an impact in Memphis pretty damn quickly, didn't he?
Absolutely. And the deal on that... I guess they had brought him in. I think somehow he had shown up at the Coliseum, was looking for work sometime around this time. And they were like, and they had him cut a promo, right? Or he was like, well, let me, or he did his jive talking for Jerry Jarrett. He was in the back and Jimmy Hart was just immediately taken with him. And he called Lawler and he's like, this has got to be, because they had done that turn with Tommy Rich, and so they needed an opponent, fast for Lawler to come back and face the headline in December. And Hart was just like, man, you got to see this guy. He talks just like Dusty Rhodes. And so the whole idea was to have it portrayed that it was Dusty under a hood. And that's why he was the Dream Machine, the American Dream, the Dream Machine. And they even did this thing in the Memphis programs where Lawler did this drawing of the Dream Machine. It was definitely his artwork. And they had this little Jive Talking poem where it was like all these Dusty references. And the reason he was wearing the mask is because he didn't want to damage his reputation when the world sees what he does to Jerry Lawler.
Yeah, that, and well, if you didn't know, I mean, yeah, if you didn't, I mean, you think about Dusty was a little bit bigger than Troy was, but if you didn't know, you listened to the promos, I mean, you could maybe get that deal, you know. So as we've talked about on my other show, Between the Sheets lately, when the Powers of Pain went to the WWF, you know, a lot of WWF fans actually thought they were the Road Warriors.
Yep. Right.
You know, and that was and that was kind of like the WWF's plan at the time, is they wanted fans to believe that they were the Road Warriors at the beginning. So, I mean, you can get confused. And all this leads up to the return of Lawler on December 29th at Mid-South Coliseum. To show you how big a deal it was, the week before, they drew 3,761. Where Tommy Rich beat Jimmy Valiant in a back alley street brawl match. And the next week, with Lawler, they drew 11,069 fans, where Lawler pinned the Dream Machine, and in doing that, was able to get a match with Jimmy Hart and beat Jimmy Hart by DQ. And Lawler returning was like the big shot in the arm that the promotion really needed at this time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. And again, that's one of those shows where I was able to beg my uncle to take me. And I've been to a couple of I went to a couple of sellouts after that, and cards where they almost sold out. I went to the Lawler Idol Hair match, but I think just because of the circumstances that Lawler, you know, had pretty much been on the shelf for a year, there was so much heat on Hart. He had this mysterious new heel coming in. The Dream Machine. It was talking like Dusty. They were kind of portraying that it was Dusty. It was the biggest babyface draw in the country. And it was just all this perfect storm. I've never felt that kind of energy in a building before for a sporting event. It was, and we got there early, and we were able to get some of the last seats that were available in general admission. But they had, you know, eventually they had to lock the doors, and they had people breaking down the doors trying to get in, and they had to call police. And there was the first time I can recall being in the Mid-South, a sold out Mid-South Coliseum, and I don't know how people were still getting in, but there were people sitting in the aisles. That's, I mean, it was such a huge, and with that, and man, and when that arena went dark, and Lawler did that, Lawler had been to a concert, a Kiss concert at the Mid-South Coliseum, where they came up through the stage, and so he works with somebody at the Coliseum to kind of recreate that. And man, when that happened, that place just went absolutely crazy. Ugh.
Yeah, and the TV the Saturday before was one of the best television shows, because they did this deal where they sat down with Lawler, they showed this great video of him beating pretty much all the top names in wrestling in that time period they worked against, and it was just a great hype show for his return. And Memphis was so great about doing stuff like that.
They devoted a lot of the Memphis show, and then after the show ended, he and Dave Brown sat down for an hour long retrospect of his career.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about, that one. Yeah.
That was tremendous. And as a kid too, to see like all of these great Lawler moments. And they kind of like, and what they were able to do with that, you know, they showed highlights of LeDuc. And part of the reason they turned Valiant is because he and Lawler still had this unfinished business to settle. Because for a while, Valiant had been coming out, even though he was babyface, he was wearing Lawler's crown.
Mm-hmm.
So they're showing all these old clips, and they're basically setting up, you know, this list of opponents for the next few months, because they're showing all the history that Lawler has with all of them. Like, you know, they brought in LeDuc as one of the guys Hart brought in. That was really, really cool.
Yeah, and, you know, you go into 1981 and you look at, you know, what happened. You get Lawler over Ellering, that he gets Hart and Mystery Partner after that, and it's Valiant, and he beats them in a handicap match. Austin Idol comes back, And doing that, Lawler beats him, and he also won Jimmy Hart's gold record of Keep On Dancing. And you got to describe that whole deal there with Lawler and the gold record.
Lawler comes out there and he says that, you know, if he wins it, then, you know, he wants to take something personal, something that Jim, you know, means more to Jimmy Hart than money or anything like that. And so that gold record, you know, at the height of his music career, and he told fans that he was going to go out to the Memphis Bridge and dump it over. And so when they get that, you know, he wins the gold record, he beats Idol, and they go out there, and there's so many fans there that the camera crew can't even get a good shot of it. But Lawler throws the thing. And Lawler, in his interview later on, he said, you know, at first, I was kind of hesitant to get rid of it because I thought this thing might be worth a lot of money. Turns out it's just like Hart. It's cheap and worthless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
He goes, so it hit the water there and it just kind of broke in half and it spiraled until you never saw it again. And that's the same thing that's going to happen to Jimmy Hart.
Yeah.
By the time I get through with it.
Yeah. And of course, you mentioned LeDuc. LeDuc comes in the next week, beats Lawler by DQ, and then Lawler gets 10 lashes. So they do that, uh-huh. And then Ron Bass comes back after being gone for a while. Lawler beats him, and they just bring in all these different people. Idol's back, Lawler beats him. Then February 9th, in front of 9,000 fans, Hulk Hogan comes in. Uh-huh. And that was an interesting deal because Hulk had been there as a babyface, but here he is as his Hulk Hogan persona from WWF. And Madman's just probably been on so many commercial tapes and people have seen it. But how weird was it seeing Hulk Hogan working Jerry Lawler in Memphis?
Well, I thought that was pretty cool because, again, just being a huge mark for the wrestling magazines, you know, Hogan was all over the wrestling mag. And so, to me, he had somebody who had gone from Memphis and gone to – and at that time, this is before I saw WWF TV – I didn't realize how lame WWF TV was. From reading the magazines, it sounded like a really hot area. And Backlund must be the world's best because he beats all these guys clean and all this kind of stuff. So I hadn't seen how boring their TV was. And so I just thought, man, Hulk Hogan's gone and he's become a big star. New York still had that mystique to me as a kid. But it's kind of funny. In the ads, in the Memphis newspaper, he wasn't billed as Hulk Hogan. He still billed as the Hulk. Because that's how the fans here remembered him, and that was a favor. That was obviously a favor to Jerry Jarrett to come back and do that for Lawler.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. And they, God knows, they used that damn clip for years and years and years.
Oh, oh man,
how great was that in retrospect, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and they actually at one time they showed it. They kind of like doctored the footage a little bit to make it seem like Lawler had actually pinned him in the match because Hart came in there with the cane right when they were counting three. And at one point, they kind of did a little deal where they were trying to make it look like Lawler had actually pinned him. But yeah, they ran that match a lot after Hogan became champion and they started promoting in Memphis. They were constantly showing that.
Oh, yeah. Then we have Idol and Dutch coming back in. Lawler's using the Fargos to help him out and that type of deal. We got Lawler going to Revan. Then March 16th, 81, we get Lawler over Jack Briscoe. And you can tell what they're trying to do. I mean, they're going full Lawler as you know, the best guy in the world here, and he's beating all these different guys, and here he is beating Jack Briscoe, former NWA World Heavyweight Champion.
Yeah, they brought in he beat Terry around this time. He beat Dory Funk Jr. Yeah, so they were, you know, bringing out all these heavy, you know, all these heavy guns, all this heavy artillery, all the former NWA champions. And actually it kind of culminated, I think, a match in May with Lance Russell kind of got over the fact because it's the first time ever that three NWA world champions have been in the ring at the same time. And it was Lawler and Briscoe, because I guess they did a deal after Lawler pinned Briscoe as a heel that Jimmy Hart somehow ripped him off some money or whatever. And so Lawler brought in Briscoe to go against Terry and Dory Funk. And I guess the deal was what, three former NWA world champions and a former CWA world champion. So four world champions in the ring at the same time. And I begged my uncle to take me to go see that one as well. And that was around the time they did the whole empty arena thing, which was also bizarre.
Yeah, I was about to get to that. You know, because Terry makes his first appearance on March 23rd. Dory comes in on March the 30th. And Terry Funk in Memphis. I mean, what of all the things you think about, okay, Terry Funk in Memphis, you know, this is like kind of like maybe a culture shock type deal. But my God. You know, him showing up in the studio, wrecking the studio, the empty arena match. I mean, this is some of the best stuff of Terry Funk's career is in Memphis. I mean, what was it like seeing that this complete maniac terrorize Memphis?
Yeah, Terry was tremendous. And, you know, that first match that he and Lawler had where Lawler won by count out. And I think Cornette's one of Cornette's favorite matches of all time. And I think Cornette would, whatever he was, working with some younger talent, he would always show that match, you know, for psychology and selling. And and Cornette was actually taking photos at ringside during that match. But I thought Terry was just absolutely crazier than shit. And that and the empty arena thing, I remember watching that and looking at him, and my sister and I were both speechless because it was such a bizarre. You know, first of all, they show the whole intro with like Lance Russell smoking a cigarette in the Mid-South Coliseum.
Yeah,
it sounds like he's like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this crazy thing is going to come on. Well, you know, we got a camera here, and let's just see. And he's like taking a puff of a cigarette, you know, and then, oh, okay, you want to? Okay, yeah, we'll do an intro, and then if this crazy thing happens, it happens. And so it just had this hint of realism to it. Although, you know, the whole thing is ridiculous when Lawler comes out. He's like, Lawler's got the cape and the crown. The crown, like he just pulled up the parking lot wearing on a horse or something.
Which he did come out on a horse once.
And Terry Funk calls him out on it. He goes, "What are you doing, you idiot?" He goes, there's nobody here to see you and your stupid crown and your kin crown. Oh, geez.
And then that whole thing with the my eye, Lance, my eye, and that was just. That's masterclass stuff right there. That's
yeah, I've always tried to pick because that was actually that they did that obviously before a Monday night show, you know, because it was all set up for wrestling. And so I've always been trying to like figure out like, okay, what night did they do that?
I had it pinned down. I'm trying to remember. I think it may have been the April the 6th show. The same show they did Texas Death with Lawler and Plowboy Frazier and just Dory and Terry. I think it was okay, the April 6th show.
Okay, maybe it was.
Yeah, and then...
And again, that's a funny one, too. That's a funny one, too. Like, if you look at some... I'm trying to see the house for the... Okay, yeah, the crowd jumps to 8,000. I think the crowd had been in the high sixes, low 7,000 range, and then Lawler brings in Plowboy Frazier. His partner, and the crowd jumped. just one of those guys that was like super over in Memphis, and of course later on, you know, did the Uncle Elmer deal, but man, yeah, Plowboy could spark the houses when they brought him in occasionally.
And also in that show, you had a Mask versus title match for the Southern Tag Titles as Bill Dundee and now Babyface Dream Machine beat two young Japanese fellows, Masafuchi and Atsushi Onita. And Fuchi and Onita in Memphis is real fun to watch. And Memphis, I mean, you look at Onita, where he would what he would do later on in life, and you could tell that the two promotions that clearly influenced his thinking of how, you know, he wanted wrestling to be was Memphis and Puerto Rico. And FMW, the early days of FMW is so Memphis-y. And that's a great credit to Jerry Jarrett in Memphis that, you know, Onita took that style and created FMW after it, basically.
Yeah, and when Onita and Fuji recreated the concession stand brawl with Ricky Morton and Eddie Gilbert.
Oh, God, but, yeah.
That was the match that really got over. That was the night that Rick Morton and Eddie Gilbert really eclipsed their father's shadows. You know, They kind of, I think I wrote in one of my columns, but they went into that ring, young men or young boys, and they left men. And I remember like they got over as being, serious wrestlers, and tough, after that. And really it was almost actually better than the Lawler Dundee, Blonde Bombers.
I prefer over that myself too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Babyface Dream Machine. What'd you think about when Troy Graham became Babyface?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, seriously, it was like having Dusty Rhodes in the territory. Yeah. You know, he did a lot of the same bumps and just fun. It, you know, of course, he did all the Dusty style, but this time Babyface promos, which the whole gimmick was really well suited for. No, I thought he was tremendous. And he and Dundee had the Southern Tag Titles, and I loved the Dream when he turned babyface.
Now they brought another guy in as babyface to team with Lawler, Kevin Sullivan, who had been in Georgia as a heel and had become, you know, pretty ripped at this time as bodybuilder Kevin Sullivan. And of course he turns on Lawler and joins the First Family, starts a team with Wayne Ferris. And the Wayne Ferris Kevin Sullivan tag team, and this edition of the First Family, to me, is like the real, true, like First Family of wrestling right here. When you have Sullivan and Ferris, you're gonna have
Nightmare and Speed.
What's that?
Nightmare and Speed.
Nightmare. So originally it's Danny Davis and David Oswald as the original Nightmare, and then of course he leaves, and Ken Wayne becomes Speed. Then Super Chick Donovan.
Oswald, something happened with Oswald. Then Ted Allen came in.
Yeah,
right?
Ted Allen came in. Yeah. And this First Family is one of my favorites.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And this is when, you know, they were doing, this is when they started like all these crazy gimmick matches and dream matches and stuff like that. And, you know, with, the world title wasn't even, you know, Robinson left the territory, and the whole thing was really titles. The whole emphasis on titles went out the window. You know, the Southern title wasn't even talked about that much. It was all about Lawler getting to heart and Lawler. It was like a gang war with Lawler and Dundee, and Mantell turned babyface around this time, and they did that. And one of the great promos ever, really, was when Mantell came out and explained why he ran out to help Dream Machine and Dundee when Tojo and Onita and Pucci were jumping, you know, had them outnumbered. And he gave that speech about, you know, how he served in Vietnam, which was a shoot. And he said, you know, and I looked out and I saw those three Japanese beating on Dundee and the Dream. And I looked over and I saw a little boy, and he had an American flag in his hand, and he dropped it. And buddy, I just snapped.
Oh, so great.
Oh my gosh. And that's one of those two that I remember as a kid just loving that interview, and just immediately just was, you know, Dutch was one of my new heroes. And it was one that I found the promo years later. I was like, God, I hope this lives up to my memory of it. And I think it's tremendous.
Yeah. And Dutch was made for this role he's taking on now as the tough guy, babyface that, he was portrayed to a team in Memphis. And also another guy coming in this time as a babyface is Steve Kern. And Steve Kern comes in, right. and he's another guy who, you know, everybody remembers, you know, the Fabs, Stan and Steve, but Steve Kern on his own, I mean, he was a Georgia heavyweight champion. He was national television champion, big deal in Florida. I mean, he was a guy that, you know, there was talk of at one point, maybe putting the NWA World Heavyweight title around his waist. I mean, Kern was a big deal as a singles guy, and here he comes in Memphis, and he adapted very well here, you know, in this run.
Yeah, I liked Kern right away, and he and Dundee, formed a good team, and think about Kern too. You know, he was a good looking guy, but you know, he was very straightforward, his interviews, and his interviews weren't great by any means. But just, you know, he was kind of like what you see is what you get, and just a straight shooter. And they really you know, moved him up the cards fast. And they did a deal on TV, I think, where he broke Jimmy Hart's leg. And
I thought
Kern was a great fit for the territory.
Yeah, Jimmy Hart was trying to recruit Steve Kern to join the First Family. And Kern got Jimmy to agree to put his leg on the bottom rope as a sign of trust that he wasn't going to jump off the top rope on his leg. And, of course, he jumped off the top rope on his leg and, you know, broke his leg. And then Jimmy goes and wins the Southern Heavyweight title, you know, as part of the Dream Match deal where Kevin Sullivan and Wayne Ferris were the referees. And this kicks off an era in Memphis where – this is where Memphis television really becomes like Memphis television. As you watch 1980 stuff, and there's a lot of stuff that goes on. And you watch early 81, and yeah, they have some really fun angles. But this is an era where, I mean, like you said, it's gang war. And it's like every week there's just all these wild run-ins and stuff going on, tar and feathering at one point, and the dream matches. And I mean, what was your opinion of this like crash TV era in Memphis?
Well, I mean, I thought it was really exciting, and obviously, you know, I got hooked into the whole into wrestling to begin with all the crazy stipulations with Lawler and Dundee back in the 70s, and this was like sort of reliving that era, you know, which every week the stakes would be really high. But there was a part of me too, though, that really wanted Lawler to stop messing with all this stuff and to get back chasing the world title, because again, you know, all the wrestling magazines were written toward guys like trying to get a contention for a world title shot. And here Lawler was beating all these guys. As a matter of fact, when I went to that match with Lawler and Briscoe against the Funks, Terry ended up sneaking a pinfall, like did something, and ended up sneaking a pinfall on Lawler. And I remember walking out with my uncle, and I looked up and I was like, oh, gosh. He's like, what's wrong? And I said, I just wonder if this is going to hurt Lawler in the ratings. So for me, I was like, I was wanting him to kind of get the situation taken care of, get rid of Hart so he can get back to concentrating on the world title. You know, any match was that where Lawler won, he could get his hands on Jimmy Hart was always kind of a big deal.
And you look at that show you're talking about, they drew 5,700 fans, which, you know, that's not that great of a house considering that main event. And then you look at 2 weeks later, it's 7,000 fans for Dream Machine, Lawler, Mantello, Sullivan, Ferris, and the Nightmares. And then 8,000 fans for Sullivan, Ferris, Nightmares versus Lawler, Dundee, Dream Machine, and Dutch next week. So, I mean, that's a crowd. And the Dream matches drew over 10,000 fans. You know, where Lawler beat Hart in a no DQ lumberjack match where all the lumberjacks were the baby faces. And
I think at some point they had a sellout with I think Lawler and Dundee versus Dream Machine and Bugsy McGraw.
Yes, we're getting to that because Bugsy McGraw shows up during the Southern Heavyweight Title Tournament in July 20th, and Steve Kern beats Bugsy to win the Tennessee version of the tournament. And Bugsy McGraw was an interesting fit in Memphis. He had been in Florida working as a babyface and got over real big there. And here he is in Memphis and becomes one of the top guys in the First Family immediately. And he was interesting. What are your thoughts about Bugsy here?
Yeah, I would have thought that maybe he would have been better suited as a babyface and would have gotten over as a babyface in Memphis, just looking at, you know, how Valiant had gotten over and Roughhouse Fargo. And now I remember just thinking he was really strange. And he always had a t-shirt on that just said Life. Which I thought was just, you know, strange as a kid. But he wasn't in the territory for too long though. And then they, you know, Memphis usually, if, you know, if a guy lost if Memphis would usually take stipulations really seriously, but they really did some damage. They really kind of took some liberties with the loser leave town match stipulations starting in August.
Oh yeah, and that show with Lawler and Valiant versus Dream Machine and Bugsy drew 11,600 fans. So that's a hell of a house, right there.
Right, that's an overflow crowd at the Coliseum.
Yeah, and another thing at this time period too, that, I mean, Lawler's still working Memphis shows, but Lawler's starting to do a lot of runs in Florida. He's starting to make appearances in Florida a good bit. And that kind of was affecting the other towns.
Yeah.
What do you think about Lawler, you know, starting to venture out a little bit? Was there any fear that he might leave Memphis and go somewhere full time, somewhere else full time?
No, I always looked at it as a kid. I used to love it whenever I would see like Lawler in different areas, because he was even kind of brought in as a special attraction, or he'd be in there with like a headliner, you know, like, you know, Memphis a lot of times, I mean, they would bring in big names, but they could also get by with, you know, having a guy like Torrey Graham, who, you know, on top. And, you know, it wasn't like the Crockett territory in Florida, where you had all these huge names that were nationally recognized as being the tops in the profession. So whenever I would see Lawler, you know, on a card in Florida, I would always take that like he's going out and finding the best competition so he can rise in the ratings and all that kind of stuff. But I guess you know, based on the fact, I guess they showed the empty arena match in Florida, and I guess Dory Funk Jr. was booking Florida at the time, and so I think he was really high on Lawler, and so they brought the Funk feud to Florida basically.
And yeah, you talk about the Loser Leaves Town Stips and stuff like that. There's a lot of, you know, stuff going on here. August 31st, the Gibsons of the Nightmares, No DQ, Loser Leaves Town, Lawler and Dundee over Dream Machine, Jimmy Hart, No DQ, Loser Leaves Town. Next week, you have the Nightmare and Speed over Plowboy Frazier and No DQ, Handicap Hair vs. Hair. The Heartbreakers, Joe Cagle and Rocky Sorter over Eddie Gilbert and Ricky Morton, No DQ, Hair vs. Southern Tag Titles. Steve Kern versus Buzz McGraw, No DQ, Hair versus Mid-America title. Dream Machine of a Jerry Lawler, No DQ, Loser Leaves Town match to win the Southern Heavyweight title, which brought Jimmy Hart back. But the key thing is, if Dream Machine had lost, the entire first family had to leave town. But there was a special trick here.
Right.
It was a special referee, you know, a guy who had been working in Memphis for years, an undercard guy, you know, would get the TV title here and there, and in fact, the real television. But Coco Ware was a referee, and he turns heel. And Coco Ware...
I remember being shocked at that.
Oh, yeah. Coco Ware, if you only know Coco Ware from Coco Beware with Frankie in WWF, go watch him in Memphis as a heel, and after rechristened himself Sweet Brown Sugar, because he was phenomenal here.
He was great. And then he quickly lost a hair match. Which again, this is like kind of a unique Memphis thing. He lost. They didn't like build it up where it was a hair versus hair. They did a deal where it was a battle royal, and the winner. And when it came down to two guys, the winner would get $10,000, and the guy who was left in the ring last but got eliminated, the runner up to the battle royal would get his head shaved. And Dundee ended up winning the battle royal, and Sweet Brown Sugar got his head shaved. But it only kind of added to his whole persona. And you know, suddenly this you know, kid who, whenever he had interview time, Coco Ware, he was always very polite, didn't say much. And suddenly, man, it was almost like a completely different guy. It just totally transformed. And he and Lawler had some tremendous matches.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. And then, you go, so Lawler had left town. Well, they did a deal at the Cook Convention Center. Now, they would have to go there every now and then due to the fair being held at Mid-South Coliseum. And they did it at the Cook Convention Center on September 26th. And we're talking about stipulations. No DQ, no time limit. Lawler comes back. Loser leaves town with Hart versus Valiant leaves town. Shaves head and Southern Heavyweight title. As Jimmy Valiant beat the Dream Machine to retain the title. But then lost the Loser Leaves Town match to Jimmy Hart right after that. So he was able to get Lawler back, but he lost to Jimmy Hart.
right. And it was just a way to, I guess, to get, okay, you're going to bring Lawler back, but now they got to get rid of Valiant. So we're going to do it all in one match. And at the end, you know, it's kind of funny. The whole idea was to settle the issue between Lawler and Hart. And after over a month of Loser Leaves Town matches, the two people left standing were Lawler and Hart. And I was kind of wondering, too, like, if Lawler wins that match and the entire first family has to leave, well, who's going to wrestle the next week? I mean, half the promotion
Look at that. Your only heels that were not first family members at that time were Onita and Fuchi.
Right.
So they're bringing in a whole bunch of heels that, you know, that come in, which they did that before. Remember, because Hart, I mean, Lawler earlier in the year got rid of Gypsy Joe, the Angel. He got rid of the whole first family. Jimmy Hart had to start over from scratch.
Right. And Hart came out there and gave that promo like he was quitting. Yes. It's because his kid was getting picked on at school and the whole.
Oh yeah, that's one of the great promos from Jimmy Hart that year. That one, and then the promo, the first family picnic. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, that's a great one. Yeah, but it's like, and you know, first of all, I love guys in normal everyday clothes with their mask on. I think he had Nightmare at Speed, and they were all wearing like polo shirts, and they're having a picnic, and what is it assumed to be spiked punch.
Yeah, is it true that Jimmy Hart was legit drunk during that? That was a rumor.
I don't know. I don't think Jimmy Hart drank, though. I think he and Lawler both. That's how they connected when they were making a record. Because I guess a bottle of Jack went around, and all the musicians were drinking it, and then Lawler and Hart passed on it, and then a joint went around, and Lawler and Hart passed on it, and then they kind of bonded during that session.
Well, that's cool.
Both of them were teetotal.
Yeah. Hart's hell of an actor, because he acted like complete drunk during that segment. So got to give him that. And yeah, you got to see the first time picnic segment. It's just tremendous. The Jimmy Hart in cut off shorts and an unbuttoned shirt, just and Wayne Ferris acting like a complete nut. And yeah, it's fun stuff. Now, October 12th at the Mid-South Coliseum, we see a guy make his debut that wasn't a wrestler, but he would make a big impact the next year as Andy Kaufman shows up and wrestles three women from the audience. Now, Andy Kaufman's a huge celebrity at this time period, you know, on Taxi as Laca Gravis. And what was it like seeing him work in Memphis against women?
I couldn't understand it because my dad was a huge fan of the Taxi show, and I loved it too. And, you know, I knew him, you know, as Lawler says, you know, like, oh, everyone see, you know, when they're on Letterman together, and he goes, yeah, everybody's saying Andy is the lovable Lasky character, but that's not the Andy Kaufman that I saw. And then they, you know, he introduces those promos that Kaufman would cut. Yeah, I was really confused, you know, because Andy just came across as this lovable, nice guy on Taxi, and suddenly to come in, you know, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, when they say the story is that, you know, Andy was trying to do it at Madison Square Garden and he got turned down in some other areas. And Bill Apters knew that Lawler in Memphis would be would certainly take him. And it was just the perfect atmosphere, really, you know, because if Andy had gone to New York and done it and Vince McMahon Sr. had given the green light, you know, that whole deal about being from Hollywood, I mean, that it would have had the same effect as it had on the people of Memphis. You know, and the fact that he was wrestling women. And actually, Lawler told me later that all of those matches that he had with women were shoot.
Yeah, I heard that too.
And they were like, Andy, are you sure? And that the Foxy, the African-American lady who he had the most trouble with and who had it was the kind of the catalyst for Lawler to come out there. And for them to square off, the second match I think was rigged between those two, but all the ones before that weren't, and there were times where it looked like Andy was going to get his clock cleaned.
Yeah, and this was like a one-off deal at this time period, because so Kaufman's coming back later on. Now Dream Machine has turned heel, and on television they played this great video set to Alley Oop, the old 50s song, and Lance Russell makes the mistake of kind of laughing after the video, and then Dream Machine comes out and attacks Lance, and that's one of the very few times that Lance Russell was ever physically assaulted on television. What'd you think about seeing that, you know, seeing Lance get hit?
Yeah, I was really shocked when that happened, and I think Lance was too. I think they were... They kind of set it up where there was going to be a confrontation, but I don't think it was necessarily supposed to get physical. And Dream just kind of got carried away with it. And so Lance was just reacting like, hey, what the hell are you doing? But yeah, the whole thing was like that he was humiliated by putting a series of clips together to alley-oop. But yeah, that was pretty funny.
Yeah, and it seems like late in 81, Lawler's programs were taking a back seat because he was like working against Killer Carl Krupp and Bill Dromo as a Super Destroyer. And the main feud that was going on was Southern Tag Title feud between Bill Dundee and Steve Kern versus Stan Lane and Sweet Brown Sugar. And, you know, Bobby Eaton and Sugar as a tag team, you know, is a great team. And we'll talk about that when we do our next show. But Lane and Sugar was a really fun team, too. What'd you think about Stan Lane coming in here as a heel?
No, those matches were tremendous. You know, they were tremendous brawls, and I think they had a Texas Death Match too between those two. That was really
November 23rd.
Yeah, that was really incredible. But yeah, I mean, you had four great workers in there, and the Dundee Kern team is kind of overlooked as being a good one, but they certainly were.
And then Eaton would come back in December because he had left Knoxville, and he immediately rejoined the First Family. And so you had Eaton, Lane, and Sugar all together at one point here in the First Family, as Lane had shifted over to working against Dutch for the Southern Heavyweight title. So you got like Ricky and Robert Gibson against Sugar and Eaton, and you got Dutch against Stan Lane. And that's, you know, some pretty good stuff there. And you end the year of 1981, and this is where we'll stop on this show. A new heel trio comes in from Alabama. The original Midnight Express. Dennis Condrey, Norvell Austin, and Randy Rose. And Condrey and Norvell had been in Memphis at various times of their career, and this is Randy Rose's first shot, but what'd you think about seeing these guys here? Because they were not affiliated with the First Family to begin with. They were on their own deal. What'd you think about seeing the original Midnights?
Well, Norvell was always really over in Memphis. And I think he was doing most of the talking for him. So, yeah, they kind of came in, and I think they were the first ones that, I guess, because the Freebirds didn't have Buddy Roberts yet when they were here. And so they were the first three-man team that I saw where they were saying that any two men could wrestle in the match and all that kind of stuff. So that was something new and kind of and a new twist on it. And Condrey, too. Condrey is one of those that was always really over. I don't remember too much about Randy Rose, but they didn't get much of a push there, though.
I mean, really, I mean, they feud with the Gibsons. And they feuded with, Ricky Morton a little bit. And yeah, they seemed like they were like the next rung below the First Family for a while until they actually joined the First Family in 1982. But, yeah, it was just interesting to see these cast of characters here. And, like, you look at the roster at this time, you know, you got Gypsy Joe, Nightmare and Speed. And that's Danny Davis, Kim Wayne. You got Condrey, Austin and Rose. You got Ricky Morton. You got Roy Rogers, Johnny Rich. Eaton, Dutch, Sugar, Dundee, the Gibsons, Lane, Lawler. That's a pretty strong talent roster to end the year with, no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, I think by the end of 81 and then heading into 82, which, you know, 82 is widely considered one of the overall best years for the territory. And not just in Memphis, but the whole territory, I think, was on fire. Throughout most of
it. And that's what we'll pick up at on our next show whenever we resume this series with Scott Bowden. And Scott, man, this has been a great, great show. I love talking Memphis, and especially love talking the early era in Memphis that we talked about, because everybody knows about, you know, all the stuff that went on in the 80s, but the late 70s is kind of like a blind spot for some people. And I'm glad that we did this show. Plugs. Plug your website there.
Well, I don't have time to update it as much. Actually, I don't update it at all unless something major happens. And to me, Jack Eaton passing away earlier this year was a big deal. And again, Jack Eaton was the Channel 5 news broadcaster who would often run clips of the matches, and was also at one time in the 50s and 60s an announcer for Memphis Wrestling. And also have a great tribute to Jackie Fargo, who passed away a couple of years. But there's about 5 years worth of columns there, and it all details my experiences in the business and also my perspective as a fan. So a lot of the stuff that we talked about today, I cover in greater detail at KentuckyFriedWrestling.com.
Yes, it's definitely a valuable resource to learn from that era of Memphis. And just great stuff. And of course, Between the Sheets is one of my plugs every week and every Monday. So check it out. Or the show that should be, I don't know if it'd be out by this time as our show comes out, but it'd be in the process. It'd be 1990. And it's interesting that we're talking about 1990 on this show, because there's a lot of talk about Jerry Jarrett on that show during the end of his run with the Texas part of the USWA office. It'll be covered in high detail in that show, and boy, what a train wreck that was. So check out that show when that comes out. Scott, appreciate you being on with me tonight, and like I said, I can't wait to do it. The next show down the line when we hook it up again, and yeah, this I can just talk about this stuff forever. So I appreciate it, brother.
Yeah, man. Yeah, a lot of fun, and I think my voice is about shot. I think I know how Lawler and Dundee and Landale and Dutch Mantel felt after that 26 ball Texas death match.
Hey, this is short for me. I'm just not getting warmed up. I'm like Greg Valentine. I'm just giving. All right, thank you for being on the show, Scott. And we will see you guys down the line. So long from the Peach State of Georgia.
Travels like wildfire, good news travels slow. They all call me old wildfire, 'cause everybody knows that I'm bad news.
Bad news
everywhere I go, always getting into trouble. In Georgia, I whip lumberjacks up in Maine. I've been hired and fired and jailed in every town you can name me, 'cause I'm bad news.
Bad news.
Everywhere I go, always getting in trouble. Yeah, and leaving little girls.